yes, I love her like Egyptian. On the description, my royal highness. So many pluses when I bust that, that can't be no modest. Went from yelling quicker than crows, bitches and hoes to swing things. Over the years, I've been up on my toes, and yes, I sing things like Kilroy. Kilroy, because them folks might think he's soft talking like that. Man, fuck them niggas, I'm going off and coming right back like boomerangs when you throw 'em. With these old ghetto poems, think it is better for 'em when they can let they throw 'em. Down from hitchhiking and fighting niggas into the temple they call the body. Now everybody got it, had it, talked about it amongst their friends. Coming around my crew, looking jazzy, wanna pretend like you Miss Goody, folks, you even won't know that you got coached. Like acupuncture patients while our nation is a broke, scrape sinking. I hate thinking that these are future mamas of our chillin'. They fucking a different nigga every time they get the feeling too. I'm willing to go the extra kilo. Need it just to see my senorita get her pillow. On the side of my bed where no good ever stayed. House and doctor was the games we used to play, but now it's real jazzy, bear. With a few to play, a real player, not no flop. Having the very best of life, lots of steak and Perry on. Smoking an ounce a week and every single day with personal greatness. Tricking these holes in polo clothes, life as you conceived it. But your conception, deception. Looking into your eyes, I see your weapon and it's suppression. They're digging up in your thighs, even deposits, keep your closets open. I feel boots and jaws, hoping to get you strong like bell bars. Steadily calling me Antoine, cause you thinking that you my lady. Bitch, don't play because you're janky. I wanted to hit that ass for me and the goodie, we got danky. So thank me, you wanted that stuff, don't play illicit game. You was the only one to blame, a nigga don't even know your name, it's a shame. You cocking them up and fucking a nigga like Tupac up. I'm leaving these clothes to be the flowers and wait, don't get me. See, I gotta be feeding my daughter, teaching to be that natural woman. You'll be waiting to exhale while you other hoes be dumb and dumb. The black on black lack no star. When it's attention so that no one knows who us are. Talk bad about her nigga, guaranteed to snap like bra. Straps sticking together like grandma and grandpa pa. In this doggy dog world. Kitty cats be scratching on my furry coat to curl. Up with me and my bowl of kibbles and bits I want to earl. Cause most of the girls that we was liking in high school now they dyking.
Having no mercy for the disrespect that one. Be hanging around the crew looking for fun. Dumb, deaf and fine. They be asking y'all about mine, how she doing, how she be. I know she's sipping that wine behind my back. They squawk like vultures, off and on like twins and coaches, baby. Hey, making it like these sculptured nails. But they can go to hell and label these fuckers, cause they burn it anyway. Big boy user and abuser.
Yeah. All right. Hey, welcome everyone to the Soul Savage Show here on Studio W, The Buzz, your global radio network circling the globe 24 hours a day. And now it's time for the Soul Savage Show with your host, Q Lynn Green. Hey, Q.
Hey, well, how you doing?
Oh, I'm all right. I'm all right. All right. Just
yeah, man. We started off the music theme of the night is songs from hip hop groups. I feel like classics from hip hop groups. And I was like, with this conversation, I was like, I gotta have somebody on so where we can have like a real hip hop conversation. So right now we're on live now on Soul Savage Radio with a really great hip hop producer I found. I just randomly find a lot of great talented people on Instagram and Twitter, and I just see their posts, and it's so inspiring. And this guy in particular, I watch his timeline a lot, and he's very engaged in hip-hop conversations, and he's part of the hip-hop culture. He also is a host of the Part of 5B podcast. You can find him on YouTube as well, but y'all give it up right now for Mr. Kill. How you doing tonight?
What's going on?
Yeah. Right. What's up, please? We got the class just for you. That's in the budget.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Nah. Thank you for the invite.
Oh,
I appreciate it.
Yes, man. You're like I said, your Twitter, I follow it all the time, and I watch your podcast as well on YouTube.
Thank you.
And it's just incredible the amount of knowledge you have on hip hop, and you get really down to the crate digging magic of these you know, certain hip hop records that stand the test of time and the samples, and then you also get into the music industry and talk about the stuff related to that as well. And then also you have videos that you post as well, your production videos. I appreciate you call it hashtag making the donuts. I thought that was so cool because I'm a dealerhead as well. I'm such a fan of his production. Yes. And so I just want to get to it just a little bit, just for the listening audience, those that are not familiar with, if they want to get into the work you do. But I usually get into the origin of the people we have on the show. So I want to know, what's your history with music in terms of when you were introduced to it? Like, what's the, if you can, a song that stood out to you, whether it was hip hop or soul, what was the first record that you remember, like, gravitating to as a kid?
I mean, as a little shorty, it's probably something like Rapper's Delight or something like that. But when I was 10 in 1984 and Run DMC came out with Rock Box, like, that was it. Like, that was, you know, not the Bite Commons line. Like, you know, when I met this young lady when she was 10 years old, but it was 10 years for me. You know, I'm 10 years old, I hear Rock Box, and, like, it was a rap after that. You know, it was Beach Street, Crush Groove, and, you know, I'm from Philly. I spent every summer from first grade to eighth grade in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. So, you know, kind of having the best of both worlds. But, yeah, since 10 years old in 84, it was like, it's been hip-hop and no looking back.
Right. And your interest in everything, like you said, your sneakerhead, all these different things. What was it? Was it like, I feel like all of it's interchangeable. So was it like all that with hip hop and where it was going from that era? Was it connecting it to the sneakers and whatnot that were coming out? Because it was a lot of, you know, like, you know, back then it was like maybe one or two athletes that had endorsement deals, but then you had like Run DMC, you know, saying rocking Adidas and whatnot. But what was that connection with all those things that culturally represent hip hop? What stands out the most to you in terms of what you hold dear during that time?
I mean, I think for me, like, you know, like hip hop fashion is like the fifth, you know, we've got MC and DJ and Graff and breaking, and, you know, to me the fashion is just like number five, because the fashion, like you said, from Run DMC's, My Adidas. People forget that Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince had a line with Lecoq Sportif, a sneaker company out of France. You know, LL and Stetsasonic was with Troop. You know, so, I mean, I think, you know, I remember KRS saying I only wear Nike, not Adidas or Reebok. So for a while, I was only on Nike because of KRS. And, you know, so, like you said, to me, it's all interchangeable. You know, it started with me collecting comic books, and then comic books just turned into records, which turned into sneakers, which turned into action figures. And it's crazy because when you see so many producers, you see, like, Biz has a crazy action figure collection, or Kwame. Like, so I feel like you said, all of it's just interchangeable. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And I guess we'll get to a little bit later, talking about the origins of hip-hop. But in that time period, what was it, just being a kid, what was that like? Was it just something brand new and exciting? Because I know most of how my parents had a little bit of influence, but it got to a point, a certain age, to where I had my own music where I started listening to. Because, you know, like when you were in the car, you listened to what? Whoever was in the car, like whatever was on the station or whatever CD cassette they had. But what was that anything specific with your parents? Like, was it similar to that with your listening to music and discovering it?
See, the crazy thing for me is I don't have, like, what most people have. Like, I don't have, because my mom's a jazz musician. So I didn't really grow up in the house where I could be like, oh, Saturday afternoon, we was listening to Aretha and listening to Marvin. Like, I grew up around studio sessions and rehearsals with jazz. And at that time, it's funny, I hated it, you know, because I'm around it all the time. I'm a little kid and I want hip hop. But then, like, you know, of course, by the time 90 got here and Tribe and Gangstar and everybody was sampling jazz, you know, then I'm like, oh, Mom, show me this. Or, Mom, who's Ron Carter and all this? You know what I mean? So, like, that's the thing for me. Like, I was always anti-jazz because I was just like, I just want to listen to hip-hop. But every day there's a rehearsal at my house, so I'm being dragged to a studio session. But, you know, looking back at it, it was, you know, it all made sense to me that, you know, it's just how it was supposed to be, because it kind of gives me a different understanding towards music and everything else. There's not too many kids can say they kind of grew up in studios and jazz rehearsals and, you know, all of that.
Right. And did you want to, I mean, so you just observing it, did it make you want to play music, or was it just the production side of it that came out of it?
The funny thing is, I wanted to only learn how to play music. Like, I'm in fifth grade, I like a girl, like, mom, teach me how to play, you know, Michael Jackson's Lady in My Life on the piano or something, like, you know.
Right.
And my mother, being a musician, right, is like, nah, if you want to learn how to play music, you got to sit here and practice, you know, on some Bleak Gilliam, Mo Better Blues, you got to practice 5 hours a day. I was like, man, get out of here, I'm running the streets. So, like, you know, I try not to have regrets, you know, but that's probably, you know, of course, my biggest regret, just having a mother who plays every instrument, and I play absolutely nothing whatsoever. And I only came into production because I kind of tried everything, and I was just, I'm not a big person on just being I and stuff. So I was an I rapper, I was, you know, a good breaker, you know, I was an I graffiti artist, but I always loved the DJing aspect of it. And, you know, DJing, it, and again, it kind of, if you're a DJ, especially back in those days, you almost felt right in the production, because you're trying to catch the same, you know, beats per minute to mix albums together, mix songs together. And then it kind of just, you know, when DJs like Ron G and Kid Capri out in New York City, when they started putting the break beats with Stephanie Mills, you know, Something in the Way You Make Me Feel over it, it kind of just blended together. And that's really what production was. It was trying to find the right break beat and trying to find the right sample that kind of fits on top of it. So, you know, it's no mistake or anything like that, that so many producers are DJs, like Pete Rock and Premier and Molly Mall, and, you know, most of all these people who, like, are the godfathers of producers were also DJs at the same time, because you're kind of speaking the same language on both fronts of what you're trying to do.
Right. And you're originally from Philly. You said you live in the DMV area now. I'm just guessing that the Philly, I guess the, y'all were listening to more East Coast. Was it like, did you have any like variations of music that you listened to? What was it in particular that you were listening to, when you were growing up?
Basically just all East Coast hip hop. It probably wasn't until DOC, came out with, you know, No One Can Do It Better with that album. And even when NWA first dropped, you know, I remember everybody being like, oh, these dudes got Jerry Curls. They whack. Like, you know what I mean? It's 1988. Like, you know, Jerry Curls got played out on the East Coast in 84. So it's like, bro, are you 8 years late to the party? But, you know, of course, the music of NWA, you know, spoke so much louder than their look. You know what I mean? And it's crazy because I actually just got back from L.A. in February, right before this whole pandemic hit, and was hanging out there with some of my peoples, and it was so dope hearing their stories. Because, again, so many other people my age are like, oh, I had cousins from Texas and L.A., and they kind of put me on to different things. All my cousins was in Brooklyn and Philly, so, you know, that's kind of all we had, where, you know, I didn't know, like, in 88, Jerry Curls was still in California, because on the East Coast, they was played out for 4 years, you know, so it's almost like, yo, dog, you got a Jerry Curl, man, and you saying fuck the police? Like, come on, man, I can't take you serious. Like, who you beating
up? That's hysterical.
You know?
That's, you know what, that's accurate to the Straight Outta Compton film, because it was when they were getting ready to make their music, that's how they got Ice Cube from what they showed in the Bob, and they was like, yo, these are Jerry Curls. Like, this ain't happening over here. So, yeah, but yeah.
And it's real, because even with DJ Quick, like, I was never a big Quick fan, because I was like, yo, this dude got a perm. Like, this is 1990, and this dude is on the cover of his album with a perm. But now, like, 20 years later, my L.A. people is like, nah, man, if you had a perm in 1990, you was the illest dude in the streets.
Yeah,
it wasn't
regional,
like that.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely regional. Even though I'm originally from Oklahoma, and we got, being from the Midwest, we got a lot of music from Chicago, Houston, Dallas, and then also in the Bay Area, because a lot of the rappers like Too Short, UGK, they would come when they did tours. They would be heavy through there, you know, like,
right,
you know, they knew where the good spots at to buy weed. stuff like that. You know what I mean? So they would come through there, and we got our stuff through. I know when I was growing up, we got my cousins or anybody that I knew, friends from the Bay Area or from Texas. We got all the cassette tapes. So anything that was popping, they'd be like, "Yo, this just came out." And then I remember when Twista, before he came out with his, with Kamikaze, all that, when he came out with those records, most of his stuff was in the streets. We already knew who half these rappers were before they blew up. Like Twista, you know, all that stuff. So, and, also in the Bay Area as well, those are like Shock G, like his records that he was producing, you know, before they started popping off, we got those as well. So, that's funny you said that, because that was, I sort of have a lot of relatives, not to even get like gang related or put names out there, but I knew people there. And so that was how they dressed. They had Jerry curls, and then when you got to the mid-90s, they still had perms like DJ Quick or whatever. So when you saw DJ Quick on the cover of his album with the we was like, oh, that's what's up. That he looked like all the dudes that sell it in the street. Like, that's what they look like or whatever. So that's funny you said that, because you just brought me back to 95.
And the wild part is that was the quickest way to get me to not listen to your album. If you on a cover with a perm, nah, bro, I'm good. Like, I literally just probably listened to DJ Quick, a Quick album for the first time probably 2 or 3 years ago.
That's funny. Wow. Yeah. You know, that's so crazy, because I guess it's just because we didn't have a definite, being from Oklahoma, we didn't have a definite artist, you know what I mean? And so anything that was coming to us, we were just happy to get. Like, we listened to East Coast, West Coast, down south, like we had. And then also, we had cable, so we would be watching MTV Raps and, you know, BT Video Show with Donnie Simpson and, you know, Sherry Carter, all them. We would watch all that. That's how we would get what was latest. And then whatever was happening in the streets, like if it was mixtapes or cassette tapes, whoever was popping, that's how we got the music. And so that's so funny. Is that just a regional thing, like just claiming, like, this is my city? Is that a thing, like a territorial thing, or was it just, that was just a time period?
Definitely. No, it was always a regional thing. And the beautiful thing that I love about hip-hop and the culture is that, number one, like, this is something that started in the South Bronx in 1975. So for us to still be talking about this in 2020, like I'm that age of where I know hip-hop when it didn't exist. You know what I mean? Like, I'm the age where I went to college without the internet. Like, and people are like, how the hell did you go to college without the internet? Like, yeah, that's how. So, you know, for us, it always was everything coming out of New York. But that's the beauty of it, because when you think of something that started in the South Bronx to be able to make it all the way across the country to Compton and make it around the world with no social media, you know, at a time when there's no magazines really pushing hard like that, like, that's amazing right there, you know, and it's only come with maturity for me to be able to say, you know what, yeah, let me check out what Quick got on tap, you know what I mean, and let me check out what these other people, you know, got on tap, because, again, you know, I think because the East Coast kind of had it on lock, we didn't have to like what was coming out of down south and out west, you know what I'm saying, whereas the verses is if you were from down south or the Midwest or West Coast, it's kind of like if you wanted to listen to hip-hop, then you had to listen to the East Coast. We didn't have to listen to y'all. You know what I mean? And that sounds messed up, but that is the truth. You know what I mean?
I get it.
And that's the problem. That's why you have so many, like I said, when I was in Cali, people was like, yo, you don't know how hard we were fighting to get the respect from the East Coast. And I understand that, because Philly artists had to fight to get the respect from the New York people, because New York was front on Philly all the time. You know, so I actually love it now that hip-hop is what Rakim said, it's not where you're from, it's where you at. You know what I mean? Like, for a while, if you didn't say you was from New York, nobody wanted to hear anything you had to say. Or if you said, that's why I love Outkast so much. You know what I mean? I love Outkast so much, because it was like, yo, we from Atlanta, and the South got something to say. And it was like, dope. Like, yo, I love it. You know, so I love the fact that nothing's really regional anymore. I you know, I just wish people could kind of be more original, because I work with teens, and, you know, I got teenagers thinking Fat Joe from Miami. I'm like, nah, that nigga from the South Bronx. They're like, nah, he from Miami, Mr. Kill. And I'm like, you know, because you got all the people from New York now wanting to sound
like... He's trying to get the vibes right. That's why he in Miami. He's like, I got to get the vibes, so we going there, you know. I get that 100%, because it's like, you know, because DJ Khaled's from there. He works with him a lot, and, you know, all those, you know, Rick Ross, all that stuff. So I think it's interesting seeing how the sounds have evolved over the years. And like I said, we was going to get to that. We get to hip-hop groups. We're talking about the evolution of hip-hop groups. But I was going to get back to you. I only got a few more questions before we go to break. This, in particular, with your musical ear, I usually do Mount Rushmores. I ask the guests, who's their four? Like, who's your top four musically? Like definitively, who, like, when you hear this artist, you like, this is what music's supposed to sound like. Like, what's your top four? I'll say rappers. That's too much, I think. I'll say your top producers, since you're in that realm.
Is Dilla's number one, Primo's number two, Pete Rock is probably number three, and RZA's number four. Marley was in there for a long time, but I just got finished reading this book about the Juice Crew, and it's a whole lot of accusations against Mr. Williams saying he ain't really do a lot of them beats. So, you know, the jury's out on that. I kind of got answered by Marley.
You're like me with L.A. Reid, because when I read his book, he said majority of the records he did was with drum programming, and it, like, deflated me, because I knew at least a good portion of the Dills records that he did those drums live, and I was very disappointed. Programming is cool, but it's like, you're a drummer. Like, I was like, I'm thinking, now, it didn't make sense now, because some of it, like, when I hear Tony Braxton records, he adds a lot of tom sounds he has a lot of them. And if you're a drummer, you know, you don't, it's kind of hard to do all that. So the fact he did that drum program, I'm like, okay, that makes sense, because that's a lot of toms you put in that song. So, but yeah, I was the same way. Whenever I found out about L.A. Reid, it was like, oh, man, it just, I don't know if I just found out, pulled the mask off of Superman or something like that. But
right. You know, if people always joke with me, like, man, Kill, you still believe in the Easter Bunny? And I'm like, yo, bro, you got to understand that hip-hop to me was always about a culture. You know, that's why I never compare it to another genre of music, because in R&B, we don't care if Boyz II Men wrote any of their songs. Like, R&B to me is just about performance. You know, with hip hop, if you ain't write your rhymes, like, how would you look at Jay-Z the same if you found out he never sold drugs and he was from, like, upstate Peekskill, New York?
Right. Authenticity of it. Right. It's the same. I think if anybody to compare to is probably the people that have the same passion for, like, you had to write all your stuff is probably the stand-up comedians. Comedians and actors and TV shows, like actual performing live, like, and it's, they beef a lot. I mean, just coming from being around that world, it's like, oh, they will call somebody on the minute for stealing jokes and
I was heartbroken when I found out Kevin Hart had a writing team and Richard Pryor had team. Like, I'm like, yo, what do you mean y'all have teams? Like, what? That means these ain't your jokes. Like, the dog, then why are you up here cracking jokes and not your team? So, yeah, it's very similar to that, because it's just like, dog, I'm believing what you're saying, because I've always think that that's one of the reasons people gravitate to hip-hop so much, is because they're trying to find something to relate to. So I know so many people who are like, yo, Jay-Z's from Brooklyn. Oh, I'm from Brooklyn. Oh, Jay didn't have his pop. I didn't have my pop. Jay sold drugs. I sold drugs. Now you think you Jay-Z's best friend in your head. Like, Jay-Z, your brother now. Like, and that's how we kind of relate. It's the same thing. You find out Bean's from Philly, you already rocking with him. Oh, he on Broad Street. Oh, I'm on Broad Street. So hip-hop has always kind of been that back and forth. Like, oh, you're from – it's funny. I tell people I like Jodeci more than Boyz II Men, and the first thing out of everybody's mouth is, but Boyz II Men from Philly. And I'm like, that don't mean shit to me. You know what I mean? But that's how people still play on things. Like, how can you rock with somebody who's not from your city or from your borough? Like, because that's how hip hop was. You know what I mean? Like, if they're from your borough, that's who you ride with or whatever. But like I said, nobody would care if Boyz, if you found out tomorrow Boyz II Men was from Arizona, that's not gonna make you, you know, like on bended knee much less. So it's not going to make you not want to hear End of the Road no more. But find out Jay-Z never sold drugs and he went to Catholic school and got beat up every day. Trust me, you're gonna listen to Streets is Watching a little different next time.
Right, exactly. And you wear so many hats and you do so many different things. You're a hip hop advocate, music producer, you know, screenwriter, directing. What was it in particular that gravitate? How do you treat production? Is that like your main thing, or is it balancing the other, you know, like being a relationship coach, mentor? What gravitates you to the music production? I guess that's what I should say.
I think in the beginning, it was because what people got to understand is that back in the day in like the 80s, like a drum machine was like $4,000. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So like that was, nowadays you buy an iPad, it comes with GarageBand. So you could be a producer. Like you literally just buy a phone and you're a producer now. It wasn't like that in the 80s. So it's like, yo, like, so, you know, to make a demo, like you had to have money. And, you know, one of my peoples on my block had found this cat out West Philly. And in Philly, that's where everybody was from. Schoolie D, Jazzy Jeff, and the Fresh Prince. Everybody was from West Philly. So it was like, okay, we found this studio in West Philly. And just seeing the beats, the way they were made, I just fell in love with it. And I was like, yo, I got to do this. You know what I mean? Like being able to take a portion of a song and take something else and add the drums. I mean, like in 1988, I'm 14. Like, I'm amazed. Like, and it's crazy because I have a 14-year-old daughter. And it's just so crazy for me to think, like, yo, at her age, I was already out running the streets. I was in West Philly, which is 45 minutes from where I live in Philly, and in studios and making beats. Like, you know, she's still, like, almost like a kid to me. Like, but I'm like, damn, at your age, I was already knee-deep in the hip-hop game already. You know what I mean? So, and the great thing about making beats is I still get that same feeling now, some 30 years later. You know, still, you know, oh, God, that sample's crazy. Oh, I know what I could do with that, or let me chop that up, or, you know. So I think it's just, you know, it's the love for it. And then, two, how do I balance all that? To be honest, it's about whatever pays the bills at the time. So if somebody want to buy a script, I'm in my script bag. Like, maybe 2 weeks ago, my man hit me, was like, yo, I need some beats for this singer. I was like, yo, man, I'm really trying to concentrate on scripts. Then he cash at me some money. I was like, okay, fuck these scripts. Let's make these beats. And, you know, like, I'll get back to the scripts later. So it's kind of just about, you know, I'm blessed that I work with kids. For the past 20 years, I've been working with kids. I run a teen center out in Southeast D.C., like in one of the worst neighborhoods in D.C. So, you know, that's where the youth advocacy part comes from. You know, so it's kind of just balancing all that. I'll be married 20 years this October, and I was like the first person in my crew to get married.
Correct.
So, oh, thank you, thank you. So, like, when people had marriage problems, it was kind of like, well, go to Kill, he the OG, and then that just kind of morphed into doing the marriage coaching and all of that. And, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I just want to see everybody win. Like, you know, if like you said, you're on my timeline, more than anything, like, I just want to help people. Like, I love getting DMs, like, Kill, me and my 15-year-old daughter ain't getting along. Like, what advice could you give us? Or, you'll Kill, you know, I have a disease called fibromyalgia that affects my joints. So, like, I dealt with that for 14 years. I'm just starting to get relief from that. So I try to, you know, because I feel like with social media, all we do is get the good. You know what I mean?
Right.
We never get the good in the bad. And I'm like, well, if I'm going to be up here, you know, talking all this good shit about, oh, I got a raise and I sold a beat, well, then I need to be able to talk about the bad stuff, too, and talk about that. So, and a lot of people don't do that. So I think that's why a lot of times people gravitate to me, because it's kind of like I share the good and the bad. And, you know, that's what we need to kind of keep each other together. Because I know a lot of people my age who get depressed on social media because they get on here and see everybody supposedly winning. You know what I mean? And then it makes them depressed about their own life. But I always tell people, half these people on here front like hell. So, I mean, you can't get too depressed. I was coaching a couple once. This couple was literally about to kill each other. And I don't even mean like front. I mean like, yo, word is bond, like call the police. But then the next day on Facebook, it was their anniversary, and they got like a picture up, hugged up, talking about me and my ribs. And it's just like, that's what I mean about the front. And you don't got to get on Facebook and be like, yo, I'm about to kill my wife, or we going to get a divorce. But, you know, I just feel like when people go on their social media break, it's because life ain't good no more. But the problem is we'll go on a break when life is good. You know, I ain't saying you got to share everything that's going on, but share some, because there's a lot of people out here hurting, and they feel like it's only them, you know, so.
Wow. And so what you're talking about, well, before everything that you're, I heard somebody say, it was a podcast I was watching, they was like, they don't say balance anymore. They say being more consistent, and I agree with that 100% because trying to find a balance and everything, like if something's going to, you know, be lopsided.
Right.
And so you're going to always, you know, go through life like if you're trying to, I think just consistency in what you're trying to do. And getting back to that, in terms of what you do, is it like transferring? Because for me, being a musician, I'm also a music journalist as well, and then other hats that I do, a businesswoman. And it's like, for me, I felt like, because when I was growing up, like, this is pre-social media age, like, when I started coming of age, like, it wasn't the normal to want to have these as careers. You know what I mean?
Right.
And,
right, definitely.
Like, being a professional in it, like, even when I was, professionally doing, making money, it was just like, oh, you know, it's weird calling myself a musician. It wasn't until I got some years into where I felt comfortable doing it because I paid my dues, but it was the other stuff. It was like, it wasn't normal to, especially being a musician and then wanting to be a journalist. Like, those are two fields that people be like, what are you doing? Like, how you gonna pay bills and whatnot? So, I always never looked at it like, oh, I can do multiple things at one time. It was always like, okay, you pick one career, and if you're good at it or whatever, if you like the job, just get the job because you like it. And then that was all you focused on. It wasn't normal to have, like, multiple things, and you're in that vein as well, doing multiple things. So what do you call that? Like, cause you said, like, whatever is falling to you in terms of paying the bills and whatnot. What is it like, would you call that, transferring the passion, like, whatever you, cause I'm sure you're passionate about all these things that you do for a living.
You know, the crazy thing is, and I just always tell people is God, because I'm not that smart. Like, I'm not. You know, I'm not that smart to be able to get out here and really save marriages and, you know, try to educate people on hip hop. And God has just put things in me to be able to relate to a lot of other different people. So it's crazy. Like, tonight we're doing this show. As soon as I get off this call with you, I'm recording my podcast. As soon as I get off that podcast, I got a call with a couple after that to do some marriage coaching for them. You know, so it's literally like, I literally could put on one hat, take it off. We get off this call at 9, I go right to making my podcast at 9, I get off of that at 10:30, I go right into a counseling session, then after that counseling session, I'll probably sit down and try to finish this script, you know what I mean? So, it's just a blessing that I'm able to be good at so many things. But again, I don't try to say that in any type of boasting way, because it's literally just, it's God. Because I really think through all these things, I'm trying to help other people. Like, I believe when it's coming from a good place, then, you know, God will bless you with that. So, you know, my scripts aren't coming from a bad place of like, oh, I just want to be the man. It's like, yo, I just have some stories, you know, that I want to tell. And, you know, coaching, married couples, you know, depending on the person, I charge extremely low rates compared to other marriage coaches that want to charge $150, right, $200 an hour. I mean, dog, I told a couple the other day, oh, y'all been affected by the corona? Screw it. We do these for free. We'll catch me on the back end. Like, because I don't want, you know, a marriage to not be able to make it because somebody can't afford help. You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't sound right to me. Like, I can't do that. I can't see a couple who needs help and it's like, oh, I'm not going to help you because you don't have $200 an hour. Like, nah, that don't sit right with me. So I believe in doing things like that. God is going to bless me with the energy to be able to put on four hats in one night. You know what I mean? So it's never nothing to brag or boast. It's just, I feel like when you're doing things from a pure heart, you know, there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, I want to make beats because I want to get paid. But I tell people every day, God can come down tomorrow and say, you know what, Kill, you will never sell a beat on a big level, like on some old, you won't ever have to work again level. And I would be like, all right, cool. That's cool, but I'm still going to make beats. Somebody else, God can say that too, and they're like, oh, man, I'm going to sell all this equipment and screw all these records. I'm not, I'll be making beats till I'm dead and gone, you know, because it's just a passion, you know, so.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, the passion of it, that's what fuels you to go. If you don't have that, then it kills. I think, that's a whole thing, but we're going to go to break real quick.
No doubt.
We'll come back. We're going to talk some more with Kill. We'll be back. We'll be right back, y'all. I think if our producer is, well, you need some more time, or are you good?
I'm great.
We're having just a little slight technical difficulty here. Hold on one second. All right,
okay.
Keep talking.
So
I'll get a fix.
That's the producer name.
Yes.
Okay, it's fine. I'll keep
great
talking.
Interview. I'll be right back.
But
okay.
I was gonna talk about this next week, but I'm like, this Michael Jordan documentary, The Dance. Have you been watching that?
Yeah, I've been watching every episode.
Listen, I've been like so engulfed in it because it like takes me back, because I remember those time periods like when they three-peated the first time, the second time they three-peated, that's what I remember vividly. But it was just fun, like, discovering new things. Like, some of these stories I've already heard, but to hear it, like, from Michael Jordan's mouth and what the mind frame he was in during these times and how they've directed it so far, I think is just phenomenal. At first, I wasn't okay with how the order of it, because I was confused, because I was like, why are they going from 98 to, you know what I mean, jumping from his career, but then they're telling the story. I'm like, okay, let me see it unfold. And as watching the episode, I'm like, oh, this is unfolding perfectly. This makes sense how they're editing, you know, this a certain way. And so for me, it was discovering that, oh, like, that competitiveness, I feel like, is missing. I wish people, I think what I'm getting from it so far in terms of Michael Jordan, like, okay, he's a superstar, but it was just something about that competitiveness. And I see it, because my uncles and my dad are around his age, Michael Jordan, and then older than Michael Jordan. And so they all sort of had that competitiveness, because my dad's side of the family, all his brothers, all of them competed in basketball tournaments. And one of my uncles played professionally. So it was like they were always competitive like that, the way Michael Jordan was. And, you know, and it just seeing that, it's like I wish people had just like maybe like a little pinch of that competitiveness when they, because it had to be that for him to order for him to, you know, do endorsements, do things, business outside of it. It has to transfer some way. And I just thought that learning that factor of him, his like how far he would go competitively, I thought was amazing. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the thing that I always loved about Jordan, and I hated Kobe as a player when he played, but I always loved his mentality of just working hard. I used to always joke, because, you know, Kobe coming in 96, Iverson coming in 96, of course, Iverson being in Philly. My biggest joke would be like, yo, they pass each other every night at 5 in the morning. Kobe is going to the gym and Al is coming home from the club. And I'm like, that's the difference. You know, the whole mentality of wanting to be the best. And to me, that's what's missing in basketball and in hip hop, because so many of these players were coming up at a time when, you know, you weren't getting these multi-billion, trillion-dollar contracts. I mean, with this new TV money, you got bench players getting $180 million, which is crazy. You know what I mean? So I think that when you see that money, what people are seeing now is they just see the money and there's not a lot of passion for the game. That's why I don't think the game is as great as it could be right now, because you have a lot of people who – I guarantee you at least 30 to 40% of NBA does not love playing basketball. They do it because my man told me this. He said, Kill, if a kid 6'3 walked into your team center in eighth grade, what would you do? And I'd be like, he played basketball. Are you like, what if he said, no, I don't play basketball. I don't want to play basketball. I want to sing on the choir. Guess what's going to happen? There's going to be a coach that's going to make him play basketball. His parents are going to be like, yo, you can get us out the hood if you play basketball. And he's going to be good enough to get drafted. But the problem is he doesn't have the passion. He's going to be the last one to the gym, the first one to leave. You know, and everything to me is just about goals. And like Jordan and Kobe, their goals were to be the best ever. These basketball players now coming out, their goals is to like buy their moms a house, have a lot of money, get an Instagram model for a girlfriend. And that's it. That's why we see so many of these draft picks disappear. In the 80s and the 90s, you didn't see that. You know, if you was the number one draft pick, you were a game changer. Now you're seeing number one draft picks going to the D League because they don't have the same passion and the love for it, because they're doing it just for the money. It's the same thing with hip-hop. You know, I always tell people, in 92, Paris from EPMD says, you know, on Crossover, still I haven't seen one rapper living comfortably. But then you fast forward 3 years, and now you got MTV Cribs. You know what I mean? But those cats that I grew up, Gangstar, one of the biggest groups in the world, was living with Branford Marsalis in his basement of his brownstone. How are you one of the biggest rap groups in the world living with a jazz musician in his basement?
Right.
You know, when Midnight Marauders came out, Q-Tip was still living at home and sleeping in a twin bed in his sister's room. Like, your Tribe Called Quest with Midnight Marauders out and you still live at home? You know, so the people that we love and these groups we're about to talk about, they had a love for the game that didn't have to deal with money, where as a lot of these new school rappers, they just see, I can make money. Oh, okay, let me rap. You know, and I mean, you know, I think that's why music isn't as great as it could be. Not saying it's not good, but I feel like it could be greater. Same thing with the NBA. If every player had Kobe's mentality, we'd see the game would just be amazing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it was all of, like, like with Charles Oakley and Barkley, right. Like, all of them wanted to take each other's head off. And it was, and it's crazy that, because my uncles used to say stuff all the time. And, you know, like, they'd be talking shit, you know, watching the games. And you'd be like, that's not what it was. Because I remember when Kobe won his, when Shaq won, that, what was it, 2006 with Wade, when he went to Miami that first year and
right.
won.
Yeah.
And then, some years later when, they were playing, when, Kobe, when the Lakers were playing Boston and that, when, Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen and all of them were, they had got together and then they beat them one year and then the Lakers came back and beat them twice. And then, my uncle, one of my uncles was like, they was like, man, he was probably motivated to beat them because Shaq got a ring. And I was like, you don't know what you're talking about. I was like, what? That sounds crazy. Who's motivated by somebody else or whatever? And then come to find out, whenever they did win that one, he said, I got one more than Shaq. And I was like, that's crazy.
Yeah, you know, because
like,
you want to prove that it's almost like a divorce. You want to come out better, you know.
Yeah.
You don't want to see your ex-wife and her new husband flossing and chilling and you the damn waiter who got a weight on him. Like, you know, so.
Yeah, it's that competitiveness. Yeah. They related to it because they were the same way competitively on the basketball court. I'm telling you. They would be all on the same team together. My uncles, like, they won, like, every tournament they were in, but they spent majority, I'm telling you, every game they were arguing with each other. It's just like, that movie, what's it, White Man Can't Jump, like, when Wesley Snipes and, I forgot the other guy's name that plays in that movie, but when they arguing in that, yeah, they would be in tournaments like that just arguing with each other on the floor. It'd be a 3-on-3 tournament. They'd just sit there arguing the whole time. It's like, y'all on the same team. What y'all arguing for? But they were competitive like that.
Right. And
they didn't let up.
I mean, at the end of the day, the hard part is, you know, back in the day, these players never met each other. So the biggest difference with the league now is you have all these players are going to ABCD camps and going to Adidas and Nike camps. And so you have these players, like you got LeBron and Carmelo knowing each other since they were 10 and playing together. So that's why the league is so buddy-buddy. See, those camps weren't around in the 80s. So Magic and Bird, if those camps were around, Magic and Bird probably would have been cool because they would have known each other since they were kids. You know, but back in the day, there were no ABCD camps. So it's like, the first time Magic heard of Bird was in college. Like, oh, who's this white dude? You know, and so that's the thing. In the 80s, there really weren't any friendships. Whereas now, everybody's cool. Everybody got the same manager. Everybody got the same agent. You know, everybody's, you know, buddy-buddy. We hang. I mean, you would never see Charles Barkley, Michael Jordan, and Patrick Ewing on a vacation together with their families. You know what I mean? In the 80s, you would never see that. But now it's not even looked down upon when you see, oh, LeBron, Wade, Carmelo, and Chris Paul, like, all hanging out, and their wives and their kids, each other's godfathers. It's like, man, there ain't no way in hell Isaiah Thomas is going to be Michael Jordan's kid's godfather. You know what I mean? Like, I can guarantee you none of the mofos was anybody's godfathers except y'all was on the same team. Like, so, I mean, it's just, you know, a different time. But, you know, with me, basketball mirrors hip-hop, and like I said, vice versa. You have a lot of kids who are just like, I want to play basketball so I can be rich. You got a lot of kids who's like, yo, I want to rhyme so I can be rich, you know. So it's different because in my day it was like, hey, I want 2 turntables and a mixer because I want a DJ. You know what I mean? It wasn't like, hey, mom, buy me this, and I could do X amount of parties, and I could charge X amount of money, and I wasn't even thinking about making a dollar. I just wanted to learn how to DJ like Jazzy Jeff or Jam Master J. That's all I wanted to do.
Yeah, and we're going to go to the hip-hop groups when we come back. That's our topic for the night. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about the evolution of hip-hop groups. So, Will, if you're ready, go for it.
Ready or not, here I come. You can't hide. Gonna find you and take it slowly. Ready or not, here I come, you can't hide. Gonna find you and make you want.
Now that I escape, sleep, walk away.
Yeah.
Those who correlate know the world ain't cake. Jail bars ain't golden gates. Those who fake, they break. When they meet their 400-pound mate, if I could rule the world, everyone would have a gun. And together, of course, we'd be up and on their horse. Kick around, drinking moonshine. I pour a sip on the concrete. Put it at least, but no, don't weep. White clefs in the state of sleep. Thinking about the robbery that I did last week. Money in the bag, banker look like a drag. I wanna play with pelicans from here to Baghdad. Gun blast, think fast, I'll take a hit. My girl pinched my hips to see if I can exist. I think not, I'll send a letter to my friends. A born again hooligan, only to be king again.
Ready or not, here I come. You can't hide. Gonna find you and take it slowly. Ready or not, here I come. I play my enemies like a game of chess where I rest. No threats, don't smoke less. I must confess, my destiny's manifest. In some vortex and sweats, I make tracks like I'm homeless. Rap orgies before he invests. Capture your bounty like Elliot Ness. Yes, bless you if you represent the fool. But I hex you with the witch's brew if you do do. Voodoo, I could do what you do. Easy, believe me. Frontin' niggas give me heebie-jeebies. So why you imitating Al Capone? I be Nina Simone and defecating on your microphone. Ready or not, here I come. You can't hide. Gonna find you. And take it slowly. You can run away from these stars I got, oh baby. Hey baby, cause I got a lot, oh yeah. Anyway, no, my whole crew gonna know, oh baby. Hey baby, get high from the bag, oh no.
Ready or not, refugee takes you over. The Buffalo Soldier, dreadlock roster. On the 12th hour, fly by in my bomber. Cruise run for cover, now they under pushing up flowers. Super fly, two lies, do or die. Trust me, I only puff fly with my crew from like high. I, refugee from Guantanamo Bay. Dance around the border like I'm cash.
Ready or not, here I come. You can't hide. Gonna find you.
Ready or not, and welcome back to the Soul Savage Show with your host Q Lynn Green.
Hey, that's my joint. I had to match the energy of Kills because he came with the 96 Outkast, you know what I mean, Desville. I was like, I gotta match that, and I was like, I had to go Fugees on that one. I was trying to match that's the energy dope. Of what he brought. But yeah, 96, the Fugees, the Score album. I mean, I know a lot of critically acclaimed, you know, mainstream, you know, popular albums people like to dismiss, but this was a solid album, and I feel like the Fugees, like, total, like, they all fit seamlessly, and it kind of goes to the theme of what I want to talk about in terms of the evolution of hip-hop groups. I guess we could start, if we're going to talk about the evolution, we got to go all the way back, so the origins of hip-hop, and I feel like, do you feel... I guess I can start it off because, you know, we get to the 70s rap, people go to Sugar Hill Gang first, you know.
Right.
You know, that first hip-hop, which you can, but it's a lot of that happened, especially on that record label, you know, like the Sequence, talk about that first female hip-hop group to record a record, you know, whatever. And so just getting that, just from your perspective, do you think, like, groups was that, like, because I know people started it from whatever crew they were with. Some, I think majority right. in New York as well. But do you think that it was about the DJs, like, because they were mixing a lot of disco records and whatnot, you know, taking those records, you know, DJ play that, but basically rhyming over the record in terms of, like, really getting to the essence of it. But what do you feel came first, the groups or the solo acts?
I mean, it definitely started with the solo acts, you know, and the thing right. is that, like, this with the evolution of everything, like, to me, the biggest thing at first was graffiti. You know, graph goes back to maybe even 74 to when a lot of people were coming home from Vietnam. A lot of times that's how people kind of look at the graffiti movement starting, is like from that 74, 75 year where Herc and everything like that may have not really started popping until 76, 77. And then the most important person was the DJ at the time. You know what I mean? With Kool Herc, with Grandmaster Flash, with Grand Wizard Theodore. Because the thing was, you had to have the ill record collection. So it really was the person who would bring people out to the parks was, well, who's DJing? Oh, Herc is DJing? Oh, I'm definitely going to go there. You know, whatever, whatever. And then they brought in the MC, and the MC was really just there to just keep the crowd hype, was really just there to do the call and response, everybody say, ho, you know, all the people in the place with style and grace, like, that was their thing. So the DJs really is what brought people in, and we can even see that even trickling into the 80s, which is why you had DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. You had Eric B. and Rakim. You had Cash Money and Marvelous. Like, the DJ's name was even coming first because that's what it was. But once, of course, once you became once it became part of an industry and it became about selling records, then the MC had to be first and foremost, because once you get on record, just like with any other genre, you want to hear the person singing. You know what I mean? So that's kind of like would flip the switch from the DJ being so important to now the MC was so important. When it's a party, the DJ is the important one. But once it became, okay, I'm signed to a record label, we need to push these units, that's when the MC became more important. So that's kind of how it flipped. And then eventually, then you started to get into groups.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. And I know it's a lot of different rappers, whether it's rappers or singers, just to make a quick statement on it, and we'll get into more hip-hop groups from that era, from the beginning of hip-hop. But it's interesting that a lot of these new artists and, you know, just don't want to, I mean, before all this COVID-19 stuff or whatever, when things were regular, they don't want to perform live. And I think that's just so odd, because it's like, in any essence of creating music, if your intention's on creating it and you don't want to perform it live, it's like, where are you at right now? That's how I'd be looking at it. It's like, people just want to release music, and then it's like, oh, they don't. That's how you grow as any kind of like a rapper, because you know that's how I found what's that rapper's name? It's a heavyset white guy. I keep forgetting his name because I just saw him perform one time.
You said a heavyset white guy? Oh, Action Bronson?
Yes, he has like a real long beard. I forgot his name.
Action Bronson?
Yes, him. I randomly saw him at a show that I went to, and this was before he got poppin', and his show was so crazy. I was like, who is this white cat? I was like, who is this? Because he kind of reminded me of Ghostface Killah, like that rap that I grew up on that I love. I was like, who is this? This is crazy. And he performed like as well as Killer Mike, because I didn't know he had Run the Jewels until he performed some of those songs live. I'm like, yo, he's amazing live. And it's like, a lot of them, even Anderson .Paak, he does rap or whatever, but it's like more singy rap or whatever, but a lot of them built their fan base off of doing live music, and that's what grew it to where they're at now. And it's like, that portion of performing, like, if you're not wanting to perform, and that's how those acts, like you said, you know, when they got on, like, it wasn't about the MC, but they're hyping the crowd up. And so that's how that got on. And then, as well as those legendary battles, you know, Kumo D, like, against, what's his name? Like, he's
Busy
doing
Bay.
The Bodity Body Bob rap. And he's like, yo, fuck that rap. I'm like, your shit is trash. And he talks trash. And that's what, you know, you had to be there to, you know, it was a moment in time in hip hop that's legendary, but it's like, again, you had to be there purchasing, either you purchased the ticket or you got in or whatever, but that was an experience live. And I don't think a lot of people create their music for the intention of growing their fan, because that's essentially how you grow a fan base, by, you know, people want to see you. They want to see, like, your act or whatever. And so I feel like whether it's hip hop, R&B, country, rock, you have to, you know, have that intention in mind when you're creating music. Like, how is this going to sound live? How's my energy going to be like live?
Right. And you're right. You're 100% right. That's how you build a fan base. What I'm always trying to help people, one of my other side hustles is helping people with social media, is that I'm like, you got to interact with people on Twitter. You know what I mean? You got to interact with your fans. I was at a show, Terminology was a big ship Terminology show. They would open an act, There may not have been more than 20 of us in there. And Terminology just showed so much love to the crowd. He put on a crazy show. And I was like, and I had already had the download or whatever, but I was like, yo, this dude came out here and put on a good damn show for only 20 people. My nigga, you get my money. Like, I'm a buy you out.
Right.
You know, because you like it. So it's like you said, when you see somebody giving they all, especially to an empty house, like, bro, I got to support you. Like, here, take this 20. But a lot of people don't want to do that. Somebody else would have came out like, it's only 20 people out here. I'm going to do one song and I'm bouncing. You know, and then that's when you don't get my $20. You know what I mean? So it's the same thing with interacting with people. Kill, they kill. Why are you always interacting with these people, going back and forth with them? One is about interaction. You know, and for me, by me working with teens, I'm a teacher by heart. So even if somebody young says something ignorant to me, I'm going to be like, well, let me at least try to school you on that. You know, let me, you know, but again, I'm like, I'm interacting with them. At the end of the day, I'm trying to sell beats. These are MCs who follow me. I need to interact with them. So a lot of times people just come on Twitter and they just want to post, oh, here's my album 50 times a day. Nobody's going to follow you based off of that. Like, nobody's going to really rock with you based off of that. You're going to have to interact with people. But that's a gift in itself that a lot of rappers don't have, you know. A lot of rappers don't have the gift to be able to go out here and do a live show, or they don't know how to interact with people, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's what kind of shoots them in the foot, because, you know, people will be like, well, Killer, I don't know what to say on Twitter. Shit, say whatever you thinking, to an extent. You know what I mean? Because I don't need you tweeting nothing crazy, but I'm like, yeah, like, it could be as simple as, yo, I'm standing in line at the dollar store. Like, yo, why are these people complaining? And then people start chiming in, yeah, I was in line at this store. And I'm like, but that's how you interact. So you're absolutely right. Interaction is always going to get you more of a fan base. And that's why a lot of these rappers don't have that. I'll give you a great example, Griselda. I've seen Griselda every time when they come to D.C. They always do a meet and greet afterwards, and they stay all night. They stay all night. They greet their fans. They take pictures with them. There's no rushing. There's no, like, yo, let me get up out of here. So, again, once you see people come down from another state, perform for 2.5 hours, and then stay around for another 2.5 hours to meet their fans, dog, how can you not buy their music? How can you not buy a hoodie or a T-shirt or something like that?
Yeah, and what you're speaking to, I think it was Trey D from the Eastsiders. He had,
right.
I was watching an interview of his, and it was before Dre did that big tour. I forgot the name of it. It was during the, what's that tour that was called where he had, like, Snoop and all them on it after he did Dre Day. It was that big tour. I forgot the name of it.
Was it the Up and Smoke tour?
Yes, that one. That's the one. And I think they were opening for him, and it wasn't that many people that came out. Wait, no, it was some small town, I think he said, in, like, New Mexico, something random. And he didn't want to perform or whatever, because it was only like 5-10 people. And then I think it was Dre. It had to be that tour, because he was mentioning, he was like, Dre said, it don't matter if it was 10-20 people there, you need to perform, because they paid money and all that
right. Stuff,
you know, took off work maybe, or, you know, had a day off, so they want to have fun. And he was like, from that day forward, he's like, I don't care if it's 20 people in there. He's like, I'm going to perform, because people paid their money to see. And so he said it was just, he had changed his mind frame on it, so I thought it was cool you mentioned that. But the 70s, I think with all this, like you mentioned before when you were talking about, when we were talking about earlier, early part of the show, when we talk about this era, like, we have to talk about, it's always social, economics, you know, the politics of it all that were happening during the time period that influenced it as well. And I feel like it's such an important part of it, because it's like, a lot of those, I think a lot of them got to hip hop. They wanted to learn how to play instruments, and a lot of them couldn't afford to play it. And so,
right.
I think that's like an important piece to it as well, where you hear all these samples that happened, you know, in the early 80s and whatnot. And I think, what do you think in terms of, the hip hop culture during that time period, when we talk about all the elements of hip hop, the social status, the economic status, like, that created all this music that started it. I think it was just, for me, I just feel like it was those artists wanting to have an escape, and then the same with people, like, when they get off work and whatnot. What do you think that constant that created that kind of formula to where they could, hip hop could take off, like, the way it did with groups?
I mean, I think one of the biggest things was just, especially when you're going to the 70s, because it was just something new and it was something young, similar to when rock and roll first started back in the 40s and 50s. You know, the younger generation is always going to gravitate to that. And then when you start also taking it to things like you know, Africa being bought in the Zulu Nation, you know, going from being a gang to, you know, now trying to squash the beef. So you went from having a lot of gang members, you know, who are now becoming breakdancers and grab artists and things mm-hmm. like that. And, you know, when you start to see that transformation, you know, I think then other people want to get in with that. Because at the end of the day, again, I've been working with youth in the inner city for 20 years. People just want to belong to something. You know, so back in the days, it was, yeah, I want to be in the gang. You know what I mean? And, you know, then it kind of hip-hop came along, and it was like, oh, okay, this is the new thing. Well, I want to be a part of that. And then that's how you form your crew. So when you're talking about the origin of groups, you're really a lot of times talking about, you know, your gang or the people who you're running with. You know, you had the Decepticons in the 90s in Brooklyn. That was a crazy gang. But then you also get Tech and Steel from Smith & Wesson. That were part of the Decepticons. So, you know, the origin of the hip-hop group kind of starts with that hip-hop crew. So whether you're with the Zulu Nation or whether you're with this crew or you're with that crew, you know, it kind of like morphs from there. So it's like, oh, you rap? Oh, I DJ. Okay, let's become a crew and things like that. And, you know, a lot of times once you get to the 80s, you had a lot of crews that just got started out of friendships. Like I always tell people, that's why you kind of have groups like Tribe Called Quest where you got, you know, truth be told, Jarobi ain't, I don't know what Jarobi did. You know, Ali ain't make the beats and the DJing on Tribe albums wasn't that deep. Like, but what happens is, you know, you got four friends and you like, hey, you know what? We gonna be a group. Like, oh, well, I don't rap or I don't DJ. It don't matter. We'll find something for you to do. Like, yo, we friends. Like, so that's why you always, and it's funny, we did an episode of Apartment 5B called, and what do you do again? Like, just talking about, like, different people, like, yo, what did this person do in the group? Like, did Polo really do anything for Kool G Rap? Like, did this dude right. even scratch on anything? But again, a lot of that stuff was, we were just friends. You know, we were just right. friends. And you don't want to kick your friend out. If your best friend don't rap or DJ, and you forming a group with the rest of your friends, you ain't going to be like, you can't be in the group because you don't do nothing. It's like, oh, we'll find something for you to do. You'll be the hype man. You'll do this. You know, now the only problem is now it's time to sign a record contract, and now that person is getting 25% of that 100% pie, and they don't do nothing. Now that's when that becomes a problem. But when we were just the crew hanging around the way doing talent shows and everything, it was okay for you to just be the hype man, or it was okay for you to just hold the radio on stage. But now it's like, well, we signing this record contract, bro. And I'll tell you a funny story. A lot of people don't know this. When Gangstar first started, because people forget that Guru was an older dude when he first dropped Words I Manifest. Like, when they dropped in 1988, Guru may have been 28. So he was already a grown-ass man. And he met Premier through their record label. And he told Premier, like, look, if you want to sign this record contract, you have to do more than just DJ. Because if you're just going to be my DJ, then you're not signing this contract. I'm going to sign it, and then I'll just pay you for shows. But if you want to sign half of this contract, you're going to have to do something else. And that's what made Premier start making beats. And I tell that story because Guru was old enough to understand that. But if Guru's 28 in 1988, Q-Tip is 13. So at the end of the day, when I'm 13, 14, and we're forming a Tribe Called Quest, at 15, now that we're about to sign this record deal, do I have enough, you know, business sense to say, hey, you know what, Ali, if you're just going to kind of DJ at shows, you don't need to sign this contract. You know, and Fice, if you're only going to show up every other show, you don't need to sign this contract. It's just going to be me signing this contract, and I'll pay y'all for when we do shows. You know what I mean? Like, but that's the difference. But at 14, you don't know that. You just want your friends around you. So you all sign the contract, even though you all don't do an equal amount of work. You saw in the documentary, Tip was like, I was doing all the beats. I was doing damn near all the rapping. I had to pull Fights into the session. You know what I mean? So then that's how stuff starts to fall apart, because you start looking at your best friend saying, man, you getting 50% of this pie and you ain't doing nothing for it. You know what I mean? So which then comes into why groups started to break up. So, I mean, we're really dealing with the evolution of how things happen. But again, you know, because Guru was 28 and understood, nah, bro, if you're going to sign this record contract, you gotta do something. And look at how crazy that is. That Premier, you know, ended up becoming one of the dopest producers ever. You know what I mean? And if Guru never said that to him, who knows if Premier starts producing or not? Because he would have just been the DJ.
Exactly. And like you said, I think all of it came from, okay, you're my friend, especially with Kool and the Gang. I mean, why I say Kool and the Gang? I'm thinking about folk music. Sugar Hill Gang.
Right.
What's his name? It's a couple that didn't have, they wrote, had, what's his name? From Coach
Grandmaster Cash, right.
Cash wrote the rhymes. And so a lot of them didn't have a significant, I can see why certain groups didn't last. In the 70s, I mean, I think just because it was new and fresh and they're just doing it because they love it, and it just became a thing to where people were having block parties, like you said, that whole New York culture, you know, I feel like we talk about the Latin culture, Jamaican culture, all that. You have all the different boroughs in New York that, you know, all of them connected through the music, and it just became a big phenom. Overnight in the 70s, I think, they were just trying to, you know, make music, just doing it for the love of it. And so I think the business side of it, because when they, you know, that whole company that owned Sugar Hill Records, like, that company was trash. Like, I think they went under within, like, 5 years or something, the way they did the publishing. Like, majority of them didn't have publishing for any of the records that they had, even, you know, Grandmaster Cash, all of them. Like, I think it just got to the point to where it's like, okay, this is a new, we're doing this for fun. I don't think it was the president of, I don't think the intention of, like, marketing and whatnot didn't come until maybe Run DMC, LL Cool J era, when Russell Simmons, you know what I mean, when Def Jam,
yeah.
I think that was when, you know, that started with the marketing and whatnot, marketing hip-hop. But even then, it was still new. People didn't really still understand. They really didn't understand rap until, I don't even think that certain people, the demographics they were trying to reach to, I still don't think, you know, the others don't even get hip-hop like that. And that doesn't go for, I think people that just don't grow up in that, that have the culture behind hip-hop don't understand it either. And that could be black or white, it don't matter. I feel like they don't really, if you're not in it, like, when I look at those when I look at the artists from then, like Run DMC, I'm looking at the culture behind it. Like, you know, all those, like, Public Enemy, you know, A Tribe Called Quest, you know, Jungle Brothers. Like, when I look at that era, they call it from, I think, 85 to 95. That's the golden era of music, that whole, like, 10 years of what came out between there. But I feel like from that era, I just look at the mechanism of how they created the hip-hop groups. And I feel like it all started from, okay, we're friends, we grew up together, we went to high school together, and we can rhyme, we've been rhyming, whatever. I'm like, okay, what you got? Okay, you produce, okay, let me, you know, I think it was just a give or take thing. You know what I mean? Because the DJ, producer, whatever, I feel like they had to have, I think some of them just sought out certain things. Like, you know, like back in the day, the doo-wop groups, they'd be like, okay, we got a tenor. We need another bass singer or something. You know what I mean? Because they used to do that, you know, with doo-wop groups. They would just seek out, okay, we miss it. We have, like, the three pieces we need. We just need one more piece, and we need a producer or a DJ or something. And then they would find them or hang out with, find somebody that did it or change somebody out. Like, I think almost every hip-hop group got, like, one member that was there, and then when they popped off, they wasn't there when they signed the contract. I think almost...
Yeah.
Every group in history has that backstory, but I think just the evolution of it from there, I just look at it from when it started marketing. I feel the it was intentional with Def Jam, but I think in between there, I think those are like what they call the golden era. I just love that era so much. And when you were talking about with Guru, with Gangstar, I feel like that with, do you feel like that with Public Enemy in terms of what Flav brought? Because I feel like what he brought to it was the energy those tracks needed. And I feel like some of them had significant parts, but what's some groups that you feel like the dynamic was perfect?
I feel like EPMD, the dynamic was perfect. You know what I mean? Like, you know, both of them held their own. They did their own thing. I felt like a lot of those groups in the 80s, Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, you know, just understanding that, you know, Will wasn't the greatest rapper, so allowing Jeff to have, you know, I remember going to Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince shows back in 89, and they would give Jeff 15 minutes of the show just to do DJ tricks, and the crowd loved it, you know what I mean? So other groups. I felt like Run DMC were a great balance. The Beastie Boys were a great balance. I mean, there weren't too many crews in those initial early 80s to me that weren't. The Fat Boys, Buff, Marky D, and Kool Rock were all equals. You know, now, again, once we start coming into the late 80s, you know, early 90s, now we get into Kool G Rap and Polo, where it's like, well, Polo, you really don't even DJ that much, or Eric B and Rakim, but Eric B don't really even DJ that much. But we now know the story that, you know, Eric B was the plug, Tamale, and it wasn't supposed to be Rakim. It was supposed to be, forgive me for forgetting, but it was supposed to be another MC. So, of course, Eric B was part of the group because he was like, well, I'm the plug, so... You know, and similar, kind of similar with Polo, like with G-Rap. He kind of, Polo was the plug where it's like, okay, you want me to introduce you to me, Molly, you know, let me be your DJ and everything like that. But those early 80 groups, for the most part, everybody kind of had a position to play and played it. Not too many groups from the 80s are you going to be like, what did you do in the group again? That, like, again, that kind of started in, like, 90, you know, where you would be like, damn, okay, it's four Lost Boys, but only two of y'all rap. What the other two of y'all do? Or, you know... Just different groups like that. But in the 80s, you basically, if you were in the group, you kind of held your own.
Yeah, exactly. I think what you're speaking to, I interviewed Nat Robinson, a.k.a. DJ Gizmo from Audio 2. And when I asked him, because I was so on, like, top billing, like, that's the obvious question to ask about that, but... I like getting into, like, what was the creative process with it. And he was telling me, just with the debut album completely, he said the producer, like, they didn't know how to, this is their first time ever recording on certain kind of equipment. So he said they did that album, their debut album, on a foot sampler.
Wow.
And on a four track. And I was like, because if that's foreign to the listeners out there, like, if y'all know how difficult that is to do, like, you know what I mean? From back then, like, now it's like Pro Tools, like, it's a, like, this button you can push for this stuff. But it was so complicated how they created that. And I was asking, it was like certain, drum sounds that I was hearing, like, I was telling them that I was just such a big fan of the kicks on, of a few of them joints. And I was like, what was it, like a sound in particular? He was like, no, they just bought like a brand new SP-12, like, that was the thing then. And he said he got it, and the producer started manipulating with the equipment and just experiment with the sounds on it, and that's how they come up with those heavy drums and stuff on top billing and whatnot. And I was like,
right.
What? So they're just basically experimenting, and then this is how they're getting these sounds from, you know what I mean, the SV-12 is just, you know, playing around with it or whatever.
Right.
And they're just doing it for fun. And we had asked him, like, what was, did they have intention? And he said, you know, because at the time, the label, they were independently owned. And so he had consulted with some of the people on his team that were a part of the label. He basically said that top billing was the side B of, you know what I mean, the, like, it was side A and side B. Side A, they originally flipped it. The word top billing, they were like, yo, this is going to be the hot record, so put this one out. And I just thought it was interesting hearing it from somebody from that era, and what was it like creating a record. And they basically were just saying they were doing it, but they were just in the moment, and you had to be in the moment. And I feel like a lot of those artists you mentioned, like A Tribe Called Quest and whatnot, Native Tongues, like that whole conglomerate, I feel like all of them just did it for the fun of it. And like you said, with Q-Tip's back history, like him living at his sister's house and whatnot, like, you gotta be living off of passion. Like, you ain't even worried about, like, you know what I mean, the money aspect to it. You just want to create.
And keep in mind with that tip piece, like, he was concerned about the money because the thing.
Oh,
like,
sure.
After getting Midnight, he was like, I only have enough money either to move out or buy a BMW 3 1/4. So he chose
right.
a BMW 3 1/4, but he still had to live at home with his mom. So it's still the thing of wanting stuff. But again, when you look up and there's four people in the crew and, you know, four people on pulling their weight, it's almost like if you looked at it like you have three roommates. You know what I mean? So it's four of y'all, but you're the one doing everything. No matter how hard how tight those friendships are, you're going to be looking at those other three people in your house like, are you going to contribute to something? Are you going to kick in on the gas? Are you going to kick in on the utilities? And when they're not, it kind of rubs you the wrong way, and it kind of makes you say, well, I could do this by myself. If I'm staying in a house, paying all the bills and doing everything by myself, why do I need you three roommates? The whole point of the roommate is to make it easier for me, and you aren't. So that kind of then goes to why a lot of groups start to break up, because it's like, well, if I'm doing all the work, I can do all the work by myself.
Right, and also, it's, what I would mean is, like, it's a fuel with it as well. Like, okay, I'm here at my sister's house, but it's like, I'm tired of this, I'm tired of that. And it's like something, I feel like the mentality for a lot of the ones that were the most talented in the group, they would, like, kick into another gear, like with Ice Cube. Like, you know, he had a whole situation, you know, where he busted up people, the offices, whatnot, because he's not getting paid, you know, producing all the records, writing all the songs, whatever, he's not getting paid for. And so it kicks his creative level to a whole nother level when he gets his own solo work. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like,
yeah,
it all feeds into that competitiveness, that need to, that hustle. It's like a combination of things. It's like the frustration gets to the point, it's like, okay, fuck it, if I'm going to do it myself, I'm going to do it the best way to let y'all know this is the reason why you're supposed to be paying me. I think a factor of that is in it as well with some of these groups.
Yeah, you're 100% right. I mean, it's sad, but what we're starting to see now is you really don't have any more hip-hop groups or R&B groups, because it's kind of now just known that, well, whoever's out front is going to go solo anyway.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, we already, like, come on, we've seen the Supremes, we've seen Destiny's Child, we've seen all these groups where eventually the best person in the group ends up leaving and going solo. So now it's kind of like, well, what's the point of even starting a group if we already know that you're going to end up going solo anyway, or, you know, somebody's going to blow up. You know what I mean? So, you know, that's the hard part of it. But, again, I think it comes down to, you know, just understanding how the game is played. And I think that that's hard, because a lot of the hip-hop pioneers that we love, we forget that they were kids. Like I said, Q-Tip may have been 14, 15 when he signed his own record his first record contract. Like, dog, at 15 years old, I couldn't even drive. How am I signing a record contract? You know, and, you know, how am I supposed to know about the business and everything like that, you know? So the hard part is that so many of the groups that we love kind of got into it just for the love, but aren't going to be able to eat like a lot of the, you know, the other, these new school groups are going to be able to eat off of, you know, their money for the rest of their lives, you know.
Yes, and you're speaking to a whole bunch of stuff that I want to get on, and I think we have enough time to talk about it. In terms of the groups, like, I try to break it up. I don't like doing the East Coast, West Coast thing, but in terms of the groups, I feel like everybody, I feel like it was just determining who's the best MC. I feel like it was like a hierarchy, like, if you, like, the best rapper, like, the best rapper always went last on the record, I felt like. Like,
yeah,
when it got to that certain 90s era, it started to be like, oh, now it's a whole different competitive level now when you get to, like, Onyx. And, you know what I mean? It was just a different level. And now, like, the 80s was cool, but when it got to the 90s, when it got to the hip-hop groups like Wu-Tang Clan, I feel like the energy had, like, shifted to where it's like, okay, now we're really taking on from what they did, the battle level of the 80s of, like, Kumo D versus LL Cool J. We're going to take all that energy, and we're going to do our thing, like, with our verses. But I feel like it was like that competitive level went to a different height in the 90s with groups, with hip-hop groups.
Yeah, because I think, too, like, lyricism became more important. Like, kind of what you touched on earlier with Busy B. You know, Kumo D beat Busy B at Harlem World because Busy B was still trying to do the 1979 hip-hop rap. Like, yes, yes, y'all, let's do the beat, y'all. And, you know, Kumo D came in there like, nah, bro, like, we rapping this way. And then the wild part is, then you fast forward 4 or 5 years to the LL Kumo D battle, and Kumo D couldn't take his lyrics to that next level that LL and them was coming with. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or, you know, Run DMC, Houdini, the Fat Boys, those dudes, when cats like KRS and Rakim and Kane and G-Rap started coming out, nobody wanted to hear that, you know, that rhyme style anymore. So it's almost like, you know, big fish eat the little fish. But by the time, like, the mid-90s came, that's when it kind of came to be all about lyricism. And it's a part of the culture that I love, but it's also a part that I hate, because I enjoy groups like Kid and Play, Kwame, Salt-N-Pepa, Dana Dane. They weren't lyrical juggernauts, you know, Redhead Kingpin, you know, but they were dope.
Yeah, it was fun.
You know, and the crazy, and the crazy thing is I tell people, you know, you had tours where you would have NWA, Too Short, Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, Kid and Play, Big Daddy Kane, and Salt-N-Pepa. Now, when you look at that tour, you're like, why the hell would NWA be on tour with Salt-N-Pepa or Kid and Play? But they all, it was just hip-hop back then. It didn't matter that, oh, you was gangster rap and you was house party, PG-13 rap. It was like, it was just all hip-hop. And we could all come together. And we all, everybody just rocked with everybody. You know, so it kind of, I hated that time a lot in the 90s because I felt like everything was just lyricism. Everything was, if you weren't a lyrical samurai, there was no place for you. Which is why I was so glad when I felt when Kanye first came into the game, because I kind of felt like, okay, a breath of fresh air. This is back to like the Kwame's, you know, this is a dude wearing pink polo shirts. He's not shooting nobody. He's not killing nobody. He's just rapping, you know, and I think it's great when we kind of look at maybe who are the three biggest MCs right now, at least for me, is J. Cole, Kendrick, and Drake. And none of them have any type of street, you know, persona to them at all. You know, and I think that that's so dope coming from a time in the 90s where you had to be selling drugs, you had to be from Queensbridge, or you had to be in a gang, or you was a Blood, or you was a Crip, or 100 people had to get killed on your album. So I think it's dope that, like, the three of the biggest MCs right now don't even have that tag on them at all.
Yeah, exactly. I think that whole time period, if we can get to specific, I'd say Death Row, when that came, like, it was crazy because Suge didn't even come from that background. Like, he had the most, like, you know, clean background out of all the ones that was on his label mates, and then he just so happened to, you know, be bodyguard on the tour with Dre and whatnot whenever he didn't release NWA, and then it, you know, I ain't gonna get into the whole backstory of how Death Row was created, but he basically brought the gang lifestyle to Death Row Records because there's plenty of stories of Bloods. He had Bloods and Crips, you know, in there, you know. And it was just corny. To me, it was corny seeing it like that. I feel like what made the gangster rap authentic because it was actual cats, like, you know, like Corrupt, you know, that came from that lifestyle that, you know, that it was authentic. And with Snoop, even with Snoop, like, it came off authentic. Like, I knew, like, when you see Snoop, like, you associate him with, like, Long Beach, you know, LBC specific, whatever, where he came from. And it was authentic, but I think it, like you said, it got to the point to where people started defining, okay, this is what it is now. And so that whole climate was so odd because that's when it turned that East Coast versus West Coast thing. And it, honestly, it was just on two rappers, and then it just turned into, like, because it was real. Like, it was, like, people from West Coast, like, they was tripping on everybody. If you wasn't, it was such a weird time to be in during the mid-90s because it's like, why are y'all this, like, passionate about? But it was all, you know, territorial with where you was from, and it was like you had to pick a side. But for me, I listened to all of everybody that I knew, my older cousins and whatnot. Like, no, I think if you were just from a certain part, like, the East Coast versus West Coast thing, that's what kind of lit the match with the whole thing in terms of, oh, you gotta be. Cause you remember, like, those beefs, they basically calling each other out talking about, oh, you soft, you ain't doing this, you ain't doing what you're saying in your rap. And I think more of the battle rap, that's what kind of intensified it. Cause even with LL Cool J, when he was going against, that battle went for so long because I remember that. I feel like that energy of the battle rap was still strong with certain rappers because even with female rappers, you know, you had Roxanne Shanté when she's getting ready to leave the industry. She's shitting on all the hottest, you know what I mean, female rappers like Queen Latifah, Yo-Yo, you know. She's just going at it, and I feel like that was just the top, and that was like early 90s, maybe going into the mid-90s when she did that, and that was like her final album she did, and she was like, I'm going to go out with a bang and just talk shit. And the same thing with Queen Latifah, you know, you had the beef with Foxy Brown, and, you know, also, you know, she made a diss record against Roxanne Shanté as well, but yeah, and then Lil' Kim versus Foxy Brown for a minute, and it was just all those, I think it was all those things that, because people were, like, I know for me, certain battles, it was like you were waiting for those responses, and I think that heightened it a little bit in terms of that gangster thing, because in the battle rap, like, you have to be like, okay, I'm more tough than you, and this is how I'm going to prove it. You used to be at Catholic school, something like you were saying earlier, earlier at the top of the show, like, oh, you live at home, you have a loving family or something like that, like, you ain't hard or something. I think that played, do you think that played a good deal in terms of the intensifying during the 90s?
Yeah, definitely, because in the 80s, and I was just talking to somebody about it on Twitter, and he was saying, you know, beefs are more, you know, serious when you really don't like each other. And I'm like, bro, you know, the whole Bridge Wars with Boogie Down Productions and MC Shan and Molly Mall, there wasn't going to be no violence around that. But that's one of the greatest battles ever. You know, Antoinette and MC Light, you know, they were numerous battles. But I think now people looked at it really, like you said, from the East Coast, West Coast world, that if it's a battle, then it's got to be some violence behind it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, things like that. I mean, I think, like you said, the East Coast, West Coast war was just two people, but it was about, you know, people repping their set. And I mean, again, at the end of the day, it really just has to be, for me at least, you know, like, yo, we're all doing different things. We just got to try to find a way to respect it. You know, and that's what I always tell people on the timeline. I'm not here to debate hip hop with y'all. I'm here to discuss it, because debating would mean I'm trying to change your mind. Like, if you tell me Smooth B is the greatest MC ever, I don't want to change your mind. I want to know why you think that. You know,
right,
I'm definitely
right.
Intrigued. Like, okay, well, why Smooth B out of every rapper in the world? But I'm not here to try to change your mind, where so many people like, no, we want to change your mind. I don't want to change your mind. You know, music speaks to us all different, you know, and that's something I say on the timeline every day. Like, look, what I love, you don't love. And it's funny because people be like, yo, you don't like Cormega? And I'm like, no. They're like, but did you hear this? And did you hear this? I'm like, bruh. If I tell you I don't like a fucking tomato, you're going to be like, okay, and leave it alone. You ain't going to act like, oh, well, did you have a tomato on a ham sandwich? Did you have a tomato on a cheeseburger? Bruh, I don't like Cormega. I just don't like him. It's not personal. It's nothing against him. His music just doesn't speak to me. Like, dog, you don't get this serious if I tell you, nah, I don't want no onions on my chicken cheesesteak. You just like, all right, cool, and keep it moving. You ain't going to be like, but have you tried these fried onions? But you ain't never tried the grill fried. Bruh, I just don't like fried onions. And I'm like always making that joke, like it's just like food. If somebody tells me I don't like Miracle Whip, I'm like, cool. I don't care. You know what I mean? But, you know, the other hard part about a lot of people coming up on the timeline now, the one of the reasons why I despise Twitter is because you don't know who you're debating with half the time. Like, I was having a debate with somebody the other day, and they were saying, oh, Isaiah Thomas couldn't average 40 points in the day's NBA. And I was like, bro, how old were you in 90? And he was like, well, I wasn't born until 97. I was like, okay, we can stop the conversation. Because you're old enough to be my son. So why am I arguing with my own child? Like, no.
Right.
My own child would just need to sit there and listen to what was going on. He's like, oh, you acting like, you know, we can't watch YouTube channels. And I've seen Isaiah play. Bro, you is a big difference between watching Isaiah play, you know, through the 90s, season after season after season, and you telling me you've seen him play a couple of times on YouTube. Because unless you're Isaiah fan, you can't sit here and tell me you've watched 50 to 60 games of Isaiah Thomas play for you to make this assessment. Like, I tell people this all the time. I've never listened. I'm not a big Pot fan. I've listened to All Eyes on Me and things like that. So when people say, oh, Biggie is better than Pot, kill what you think, I bow out, because I'm like, I can't speak intelligently on that because I don't know Pot's discography well enough to tell you.
Right.
I don't think he's, but here's the thing, the problem with Twitter and a lot of people, who's going to take the time to actually want to speak intelligently? Nobody. They're going to just be like, I don't
know
about
that.
Here are times that I'm like, I'll be arguing with somebody and I'm like, have you even heard the album? They're like, no. I'm like, how the fuck are we arguing about an album you've never heard? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like,
they can't even tell you album cuts. They just go straight to...
That's why I'm like, before we even start the discussion, have you even heard this? That's why I'm like, bro, before we even go back, how old are you? Oh, you 23? Brother, go. I'm 46. Go on home, bro.
It's not your conversation.
You know, the funny thing is I always tell people, and I don't want it to make it sound like ageism, but I tell people, when you turn on ESPN, 9 times out of 10, the youngest on-air broadcaster you will see is at least 40 years old. Why? Because they can't have somebody 23 being on air and being able to speak intelligently about players who played 20 years ago, because you have no idea about those players.
Yeah, they're at that right age to remember stuff. Yeah.
Right. You like, that's why all the on-air people now, you could be 23 behind the camera, but to get on air and talk intelligently about, well, who's the greatest quarterback ever, I can't ask some 23-year-old that who never saw, you know, Joe Montana play. I can't ask you intelligently. So that's the thing, and it's the same with hip-hop. We just don't have a network where it's like, oh, okay, you know, only you got to be 40-plus. But I always tell people, no matter what you're doing in hip-hop, if you're running a blog, if you're running a website, if you're running a label, if you're running a magazine, if you don't have somebody on your team who is over 44 years old, you're losing. Like, you have to have somebody on there to be able to be like, that's a dumbass question. Don't tweet that out. There's so much dumb shit I see that comes from XXL and, you know, The Source. And it's just like, yo, who runs y'all social media? 12-year-old? Like, these are dumb questions. Like, so it goes back to, like, I'm not trying to be, like, being ageism, but it's just like, I tell people, you know, when I go home and I talk to my mother about Motown, I ask the question, and I shut up and I listen. And that's what the youth mm-hmm. don't do with hip-hop. You know, the youth will read a book and then get on Twitter and be like, all right, Kill, I read this book on Illmatic, and I'm going to school you on Nas. And it's like, nah, you read a book, my brother. Now what you need to do is come talk to me, who lived through the Nas period, to get even more information. Instead of it being, oh, I read a book, now I know more than you. Me and my daughter watched the Temptation movie. And I had a whole bunch of questions about the Temptations. So I called my mom and I'm asking her questions. I'm not calling my mom like, yeah, I know more than you and you know Eddie Kane. No, I'm not doing any of that. All I'm doing is sitting back. I saw this movie. I learned a lot. Now I want to learn even more because you were around when the Temptations were out. You know, and that's what I'm trying to get the youth to do, to kind of be like, that's great that you're doing the knowledge on hip hop. I love it. But don't now come argue with the old heads. Now come to the old heads and learn even more. Like, that's great. You got the book knowledge, but now let's get the knowledge over here. Because I always go back and forth with people on Twitter, and they're like, oh, you always say if you wasn't there, you can't speak on it. I'm not saying you can't speak on it, but you'll never understand. If you weren't there when Illmatic dropped, you won't understand it 100%. That's all I'm saying. You know, right. I always tell people this all the time. I love Marvin Gaye. I love what's going on. It's one of my favorite albums. I will never be able to understand 100% what it was like when that album dropped, like my mother could, you know, because she had friends in Vietnam. People were coming home. I have no idea what that was like. So even I could read every Marvin book and listen to what's going on 8 million times every day until the day I die. I'm never going to know everything about that time. And I always joke with people. I'm like, you think I'm fucking around? Please read some books and go watch Roots or some shit like that, and then go try and tell your grandmother, yeah, I know all about civil rights. She gonna look at you like you crazy, especially if you got a down south grandmother. She gonna be like, boy, you got no idea what we went through just because you read some books and you watched some movies. Like, no. So, and it's the same thing with hip hop. I love it when younger people want to read up on it, but it's like, okay, you also now have to be careful of who's publishing these books, too, because just because it's a book don't mean that the author is qualified to write the book, either.
But also, the only thing I would say that, added on to that, and it's some people that were older that didn't get, I mean, we know, like, some of our parents didn't get hip-hop if they were a certain era, if they come, because sometimes if they did come from the Marvin Gaye era, they listen to hip-hop as well, but it just didn't.
Right.
Taste of it, because if you come from a church background, then all this music you're probably not even familiar with, because it didn't get to a point to me to where I didn't understand certain denominations weren't allowed, because I grew up in the Baptist church, and so we didn't have like restrictions on music, but when I hear, I've had other musicians and different singers come on, and they're like, yeah, you know, we couldn't listen to, you know, they could listen to Anita Baker, like, for me, that's safe, like, music you can listen
to,
and they could listen to any of that. And so hip-hop, oh, you definitely wasn't listening to what I was listening to, because Freaky Kills, that was absolutely...
Exactly.
Because I had control over my music. And so my parents was, like, my parents at the time when they had me, like, my dad was, like, 23, mom's, like, 21. So they're listening to, like, Mary J. Blige, you know, or going back to the 80s, they're listening to LaVert and whatnot, and Shirley Burdock and whatnot. So I'm listening to what they're listening to, and then as time progressed, they got down with hip-hop as well, and R&B, when they were meshing both of those together at certain periods, like with Uptown and what Bad Boy did with hip-hop and R&B, like they were going along with it as well. But again, and then sometimes it just, like, if you were alive during then, you're not going to understand the impact of what Public Enemy was or whatever, if you're not in tune with the culture. You know, even if you may be from the same project, if that's not your get down, like if you're into more gospel music, it's like, but yeah, I get what you're saying though, because I feel the same way. It was actually a midnight, I had to order, or I got all these DVDs my guy got from me, and I wanted them for a while, and I finally started watching them, and I could tell from, because I had like it's like 360 performances on all these DVDs, so it's giving me like basically some of the episodes of the black acts that were performing in the 70s, basically the R&B groups or singers, and I could get just from watching it, I could tell who was the hottest by how the crowd was reacting to them, because it was a live audience and they all played live music, like they wasn't lip syncing like what Soul Train and whatnot were doing. And so right, they all performed right. live, and just watching it, I was like, oh, this is the hot, like the OJs, Al Green, like, and Sly Stone, like those were those artists that the people were gravitating to. And then the ones that they were like so-so about, like they don't exist anymore. And I was like, oh, that makes sense why they didn't pop as much as Jackson 5 did, because they didn't really, cause you could just tell the way somebody performs if they're into it or not. And a lot of them lack passion, some of the newer groups, and they just released, like, it might be, like, the number one song during the 70s. Like, some of the times, they give you a time stamp of when the show aired and when the song had first got on the radio. And I'm like, oh, that makes sense why they just had that one record. And just from that perspective, I can understand that era. But, again, what you were talking to is 100% right. But I'll get back to the groups. For me, I love, like I said, I grew up in Oklahoma, so I listen to, like, all kinds of different hip-hop groups from different regions, and what I gravitate to is mostly the story that's being told, and so I feel like certain groups, they kind of spoke to whatever was going on, and I just love certain groups that had that chemistry that was just fire, like Tribe Called Quest. I feel like what they brought to records, it was just, like, nonstop, like, just the chemistry of it, like, how they flow, like how Tip and Fife go back and forth, like, your own point, Tip, all the time, Fife. You know, that back and forth exchange, like, on record, it was, like, just hearing how they create those songs and who they pick to go first. Like, I feel like Public Enemy, I feel like even though their dynamics was different, Flav and Chuck D's, but Flav brought a lot of energy to records, and for me, that's what gets me turned up. I mean, listening to Public Enemy is, because what he's adding to it is that passion, and it may not have been needed for him to rap. Like, what he was doing was fine to me. And the same like you said, Eric B and Rakim, like, even the DJ's part in it, like, to me, I feel like those are great as well. Like, those contributions to it and figuring it out. And I like Outkast, like that duo, like they were so different in terms of, like, cause like Big Boi had more of that playlistic, like Pimp style. And then Andre had sort of this like futuristic, you know, style, like space age, like funkadelic, you know, Parliament thing to it. But it all came together cause they came from the same background, and so that's what I love about it. But what's your top favorite groups that you feel like, just if you just name like your top favorite hip-hop groups, like who would you name? I know you had named some, but like what's your ones that you like automatically, like these are the greatest, period?
My number one is Outkast, and people always are shocked by that because, you know, I'm from Philly and they're down south, but what I love about Outkast is that I love their authenticity. Like, I felt like we got to see Outkast grow up. You know what I mean? Like when they came out with Southern Playlistic, you know, they're talking about selling drugs and Benz and Beamer, you know, stealing cars and by AT Aliens, you know, Dre gets with Erica. He's kind of coming into himself. And, you know, then we get to Miss Jackson talking about dealing with your baby's mama's mama. And it's just like, I felt like we got to watch them grow up. Like with a lot of groups, you know, sad to say, you know, as great as Mobb Deep is, these kids from Queensbridge is going to just kill everybody. You know what I mean? Like, you, there was never no growth with it. And what I loved about Cass is that every album was different, too. Like, you never got the same album from them. There was always a different sound. And one thing that I don't think a lot of people give them credit for is that, you know, these guys didn't know how to produce when they first came out. But by their third album, they were damn near doing half or maybe 70% of the production. You know, and that's something that nobody ever talks about. Like, Outkast and Lemmy Havoc from Mobb Deep are one of those few people who never had any type of production background, who just started producing and became incredible producers. You know, so Cass is my number one. Gangstar is my number two. I mean, I just feel like Premier with those beats, and Guru's rhymes, you know, not, again, not the most lyrical, miracle, you know, scientist type MC samurai, but I never felt like Guru was whack. And then probably my third, Tribe Called Quest. Fourth, probably Public Enemy. And fifth, probably De La Soul. Probably De La.
That's a perfect top five right there. That's perfect. De La Soul, I feel like that, like, people, like, talk about artists, I mean, hip-hop that, you know, they always try to keep them in their, like, prime. But when they created their last album, that they, not the one that Tommy Boy, you know what I mean?
Right. The
one Tommy Boy tried to shit on, you know. Right. But the Anonymous Nobody, are you kidding me? It came out, I think in 2016. And even with A Tribe Called Quest, like their last album, when A Fight passed away, they were like, okay, this is the last Tribe album. Like, those were perfect albums to me. Like, I always go back to them. Like, those. Like, even though, De La's album, you can't find them on streaming, but I have a couple of their albums on CD. I'm trying to get them on vinyl, but I can't find them on, unless they're like over $100, but that's a whole nother story. But, The Anonymous Nobody, that album is perfect, and they funded all that themselves, and I just love the features they had on there. It just all fit perfectly, and it wasn't dated. I love artists that understand the time, and they're into new producers, they're into the new, you know, DJs, so they mix all that in what's in current, but it still has that De La Soul flavor to it. You know what I mean? Like Tribe, right. Like, it's, you get what I'm saying? Like Tip, like, you know, he's always been, you know, ahead of the curve, you know, he's very into what's going on, but he still created like a masterpiece with Tribe's last album. Like, I feel like it's like just his best, like top five best albums that he's done. And yeah, I just feel like those two groups right there, I feel like they're like unequivocally like the best, like, you know, and the chemistry was still there, still fire. And so that would be my two. And then also I love the other rappers that weren't quote unquote MCs, like 3-6 Mafia. It's just the energy. Right. Sometimes it's just the energy of the record. And then the time, like you said, the time period plays a good part in it, because, you know, it's just that time to where, you know, you trying to do everything that your older cousins is doing and whatnot. So they're listening to, you know, Chicken Head and whatnot. It's like, you know, sipping on some dessert. Like, at the time, I didn't even know what that was, like, all the way. Right. But it was just a fun record, and that song was so popular. It was like, and then when Jay-Z finally popped off, and you saw, UGK had already had albums out, but when he featured them on Big Pimpin', like, that took them to a whole new level. And at the time, they were featured on 3-6 Mafia Sipping on some Scissor. And I remember that time period, like, vividly, because they were all popping, the videos and whatnot. So, again, the time period. So it was just, for me, just for nostalgic reasons, like Cash Money, like the groups, like No Limit. Like, I love, even though Master P ain't top five MC to me, but just that whole group, I love it. It just brings me back to, you know, me and X, my ex, and Silk the Shark, even though Silk the Shark and raps were trash to me back then still, but, you know, Mystical and all of them, like, that whole conglomerate of groups of how they, like, collaborated, I love that, and it's, like, good nostalgia to me. But, yeah, I'll replay, and UGK, like, that's my top five, like, UGK, it just, that's how dope. They rap, it was mostly the flow of it that got me.
Yeah, that's dope, that's dope, and I mean, that's just the, and like I said, the sad part for me is that we don't have those groups anymore. You know what I mean? Like, and every time we do, we don't get like with Slaughterhouse, with the Joe Budden, Royce, Joel, and Crooked,
yeah.
You know, you had group and then, you know, an album later they break up, you know, and so that's the sad part about it now is you don't, even when you try to form a group where all four of these people are business minded, but like Royce was saying, nobody wanted to play the background. So it's almost like the closest thing we have like that is with Griselda, you know, and that they're not necessarily a group, mm-hmm. but more like of a crew. You know what I mean? But, you know, yeah, we just don't have those groups anymore because, like I said, people kind of already know, you know, you the star of the group, so you're going to go solo anyway. You know, or even with the flip, you have Little Brother, where Ninth mm-hmm. became bigger, known, you know, more than Fonte and Pooh did. You know what I mean? And then that becomes a problem, where it's like, oh, Ninth, you out here giving away the Little Brother sound to all these other groups and everything mm-hmm. like that. So, you know, I think after Little Brother, I think they were probably one of the last Mohicans of the rap groups. And that was like, what, 2000 when they came out, probably about 2004, 2005, they broke up. And after Little Brother, I don't think there's ever been any looking back.
Yeah, man, it's sad. But yeah, it's like some of the groups now, it's only one that's like real, real popular now, hip hop group, is Migos. And I
right.
kind of like them. They're okay. Like, they're not that bad. I like what they're doing in terms of, even though they're like, you know, some of the subject matter isn't like kid friendly, but I just like that they're having fun. And I feel like people try to be like, oh, where's the, you know, conscious rap at? But I feel like they're just doing what they're like. I believe them. The reason why I like them, because I actually believe the stuff they're saying. Because it's like
right.
too specific, like, too specific, like talking about, oh, I'm cooking up work at my auntie's house and stuff like, that's too specific. Like, you're naming people. Like, this is too specific for this not to be true. So, I think in that factor, I think it's just fun for what it is. And I think the demolishing of hip hop groups, like you said, is always money and then the contract dispute, you know, or who's pulling the most work and whatnot. I think that's always a factor, whether it's like, I think that's like with R&B groups, country groups, that's always
yeah.
a factor, and then somebody going solo.
Yeah, and I mean, and you also think when you're in a group, if we, you know, start a rap group when we're 16 and, you know, 10 years later, we're 26, we're two different people right now. You know,
mm-hmm.
do we still like each other as friends? You know, have I grown spiritually and you haven't grown at all? And you know, so it's almost like a marriage. It's like you kind of have to grow together and renegotiate things and things like that. And I think we see that in groups like The Roots, who have been together, you know, for, I think, almost, what, 20-some-odd years now? Or,
yes.
You know.
And they're my top two, yes, in terms
yeah, you know,
of, like, the evolution. Like you said with
yeah.
Outkast, I think that their evolution as have they grown in this industry, I feel like is, you know, they're worthy of that. Especially Black Thought, like, for me, just MC-wise, like, oh, that's another thing. We're going to go to break real quick. I'm going to ask you that. We're going to play this game called What's Wrong With You when we come back. But I'm going to ask, you just made me think of another question. But we're going to take one more break and we'll be back.
The game is rigged.
It's false. He's telling lies. We'll be back.
By other brothers rep, but the thing you know best is where the gun is kept. Cause in the night you'll feel fright, and at the sight of a 4/5, I guess you just might wanna do a dance or two. Cause he can made it bust you for self or with a crew. No matter if you or your brother's a star, he can pop you and jet without a getaway car. And some might say that he's a dummy, but he's sticking you for taking all of your money. It's a daily operation. He might be loose in the park or lurking at the train station. Mad brothers know his name, so he thinks he got a little fame from the stick-up game. And while we're blaming society, he's at a party with his man. They got the iron, the gold chain that the next man's wearing. It looks big, but they ain't staring, just thinking of a way and when to get the brother. He'll be long gone before the kid recovers. And back around the way, he'll have the chain on his neck, claiming respect just to get a rep. Take them, take them outside. Take them. is in a circle, has a kid trapped. The one with the hoodie said will hurt you. If you don't run out your jewels and pay, give up the Rolex watch or you won't see another day. See, they were on the attack, and one said, yo, you wanna make this to a homicide rap? Make it fast so we can be on our way. Kick in the rings and everything, okay? The kid was nervous and flinching, and little Shorty with the 3-8, yo, he was inching. Closer and closer, put the gun to his head. Shorty was down to catch a body instead. Money was scarce, so he panicked. Took off his link and his rings and ran frantic. But Shorty said, nah, pull the trigger and step. It was nothing. He did it just to get a rep.
Here. Hey, we back, y'all. Soul 70 Show. On the Buzz, Studio WBuzz.com.
Yes.
Hey, back to you, Q Lynn.
Hey, yes, that's Gangstar from the 91 Step in the Arena album. I love that pick, man. That's one of my favorites, too.
Good looking.
I was going to ask before we went to break, who's the best rapper, best MC in a group? I have, like, a little list, but I would love to hear yours.
Who's the best MC in a group? Maybe 3,000. Maybe 3,000. And that's no disrespect to Big Boy, because I'm tired of people acting like Big Boy.
Right.
To Michael Jordan. I always compare them. To me, they're like Steph and Clay. You know, both important, both have different games, but both bring winning to the table. 3,000, that's a good question. See, the problem with MCs, I dig so much into this game that, you know who was the dopest in the group? Lauren Hill was the dopest in the group.
Yes.
Dope MC. Oh God, 3,000. Yeah, I would probably say 3,000. Lauren. God, that's a good ass question too. Who you got? I want to know who you got.
Oh, I love. Listen, Onyx. Like again, it's just certain rap groups, like certain time periods. I call this the on my workout playlist. I call some of these artists the groups Run Them Shit Son playlist. But it just had the energy to it. And so Onyx was one of those groups where it's like, punch you in your face, like kind of music. Like it hits you, like immediately right. with that boom bap. But, Sticky Fingers for sure. Like the way he rapped on there, I felt like he, like, could eat, like it felt like he was eating my head off through my headphones, like, cause his rap was so, like, it was just how he rapped. Like I knew he meant that. And it just, oh my God, how he raps on Throw Your Guns, it's just nuts. And it's just that whole energy I loved about Sticky Fingers, what he brought to a record with Onyx. I feel like he's the best. And then ODB for sure. And Wu-Tang Clan, like I know it's like 77 of them, but like if you ask me, like my favorite Wu-Tang Clan, next to Rakim, it's kind of a tie between Rakim and ODB. If I could pick it, since it's like 77 of them, I feel like it's fair to pick two out of Wu-Tang Clan. Method Man, like, I love him. I love his energy as well, but when you talk about anticipating rhymes, the Chambers album, like, I'm anticipating more ODB and Rakim verses than anybody else's. Like, RZA's cool, you know, Ghostface, you know, I put him in the top five in the group, but for me, it's just ODB and Rakim, those who I anticipated more on a song. And Q-Tip, Tribe, like, I feel like to me when I say my favorite, the favorite in the rap group, like, who you anticipated more is what I'm speaking to. Like, that's how you determine how great somebody is. It's like, okay, your verse is cool, but I really want to hear this artist. You know what I mean? I want to hear that. And so Q-Tip, I've always anticipated his verses on an album. And go to West Coast real quick. West Side Connection, that's one of my favorite groups, top groups. And it's hard for me, I just say all three. Cause it's hard, cause Mac 10, Dub C, Ice Cube, And the crazy thing is their flow, they matched the flow of the record, and so they didn't have the same cadence sometimes on record, and that's what I appreciate about it. Because sometimes I love Dub C more on the song than Ice Cube. Like, Bow Down, like, I love Dub C. Dub C's verse is the best out of all of them. But it's some records, you know, where I like more Mac 10, what Mac 10's verse was. So I say all three with West Side Connection. And then Pimp C is one of my favorites. I like more of his verses more than Bun B's on a lot of records. And that's not just the Bun B, because I love Bun B. I love Bun B's Trill albums. They're amazing. But Pimp C, I've always loved the way he talked on it, his cadence again. His flow on the record was always so catchy. It just pulled me in more than Bun B's. And Corrupt from VPG is one of my favorites. And then Trey D from Eastsiders. That's my little list. Those are my personal favorites. But we're going to play this game with you. Oh, go ahead. I cut you off.
No, I was just saying that's a dope list. That's a dope list.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's like I try to keep it diverse. That's just what my ears go to. And so sometimes it's a little bit more violent to the rap, talking about I hate your guts, I hope you die. That's more Sticky Fingers. And sometimes it's a balance of electric relaxation with Q-tips. It just depends on how I'm moving. I can go either way. It just depends. When I'm in the gym, I want some, you know, Ice Cube death certificate. If I'm just chilling at the house, I might put on some Midnight Mirage. It just depends on, you know, my mood. But, yeah, we will play this game that we play with the guests and just ignore our producer.
It's
Will.
Rigged.
He likes to call this game rigged. It's
the
not
game
rigged.
Is rigged.
Ignore what he just said. The rules, I'm just going to give you the rules of the game and you can determine for yourself. Basically, you got to pick what I pick.
See?
It's an either-or game. It's an either-or game. It's not an artist comparison. It's just who do you have more of on your musical playlist. It's not artist comparison. It's just who do you listen to more. And so I'm going to ignore everything. Ignore everything he just said. We're going to move past that. And so the first one is Marvin Gaye or Teddy Pendergrass?
Marvin Gaye.
Talking right. The next one is The Whispers or the OJs?
OJs.
Okay. Next one is Prince or Rick James?
Oh, Prince.
Okay. So those are all bonuses. So either way, if you would have picked either one, you would have got it right because I make them up as I go.
It's rigged.
It's not rigged. It's not rigged at all. And so this portion of the game is kind of a setup because I like to, like, lead you down the easy way, and then we get to the hard path where you got to get all these right or you get a what's wrong with you. It's kind of a little bit pressure. So this is specific with Michael Jackson. Off the Wall or Thriller?
Off the Wall.
Talking right. Okay, the next one is Patti LaBelle or Aretha Franklin?
Patti.
You talking right. Yes, I knew it. Yeah, I knew it going in that she was going to say Patti. I knew it.
I'm from
the next
Philly.
One. Yeah, I knew it. Yeah, I already knew the Philly connection. I need you to go get that one. The next one is Brian McKnight or Babyface?
Oh, Babyface.
Talking right. And then the bonus is, I feel like, I don't know where you're going to go with this one, but Mary J. Blige or Faith Evans?
Oh, Mary.
I knew you was going to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Name me three Mary songs right now.
See?
That's album cuts.
If he had picked Faith.
Name me three album cuts from Mary.
Oh, see?
I would probably say I Can't Live Without You. That's off the My Life album.
Yeah.
Down off the My Life. Love No Limit off of 411. And she had this joint that was on the Mary album that actually sounds exactly like Prince's I Hate You that Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis.
Yeah.
What was the name of that song? The Love I Never Had.
That one. Oh, listen, you just did three for three. You did Steph Curry threes right there because you shot from 20 feet, okay? Because I was about to give you that was bonus, so either way you would have, you know, you may have got bonus. I'm not going to take no points away. I usually take points away if you don't pick what I pick, but I'm going to give you a bonus 20. How about that?
Good luck. I appreciate that.
I have concluded that there is nothing wrong with Mr. Kill. Ain't nothing wrong with you. You run the game.
I appreciate
you with it. Yes. If you would have picked Aretha, I would have asked you. If you would have picked Aretha, I would have made you name me five Aretha songs that wasn't hit.
See, it was a setup.
Had to feel the connection.
It was a setup.
You know what I do love.
Well, it's 51.
I love that you're making people pick album cuts, because I always tell people there are people like Prince who people say they're fans of, but they never heard an album. So I love the fact that you're making folk, if you're saying you're picking this person, like, well, give me some album cuts. Don't give me the singles. Give me the actual album cuts. So I definitely respect
And you
that.
Listen to the album. Those are the, you pick the no best problem. Albums. You talking right. So there's nothing wrong with, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate
thank
it.
You.
You
thank
dropped
you.
Some. Dropped so many hip hop gems, and I know people are gonna love this episode. They've been wanting me to do a hip hop show forever, and so I'm just glad you graced your presence on this show. I would love to have you back and just have more hip hop musical conversations, soulful conversations. It was definitely needed. I appreciate it. Is any project? I know. Tell them about the podcast and where they can find it. That's one thing.
The podcast is Apartment 5B. You could just go to my website, willmakebeatsforfood.com. Everything I do is up there. The podcast I post every week. Every Friday I drop a free mixtape. It could be anything from R&B to hip hop. I do a sample series called Milk Crate Sessions, where I have, like all hip hop songs that were made by, Aretha Franklin samples. You're talking about Aretha. I did Aretha one when she passed away. Hip-hop songs that were sampled by Isaac Hayes and James Brown. So I have a different series every week. I dropped one last week on Large Professors, a two-disc CD. You know I'm old. I'm talking about two discs. The first.
Oh, you talking?
Yeah.
Talking about my talk.
Right, the first CD is Salute Large Professor on the microphone, and then the second CD is all his production. So like I said, there's, and I got one that's perfect for you. It's called Love Is. It's a two, Jay Dilla, mix that, is crazy.
Oh,
I'm actually working on one right now called JD versus Jay Dilla, because they're two totally different producers. You know what I mean? So, and people always ask, Kill, what do you mean by that? So I was like, you know what? Let me just make a mixtape so you can kind of see JD versus Jay Dilla. And the difference in his production style. So yeah, everything I do is up there. So please come through on Twitter. It's KILAPT5B. So it's Kill Apartment 5B. On Instagram, it's Kill 889. Twitter suspended my OG account, so I'm kind of salty about that. Which is whack, because I probably was at like 10,000 followers. I've been on Twitter for 11 years, and the worst part about getting suspended, and it was on some copyright bullshit. Like, you know, I like posted a video of me cutting somebody's hair and the music was in the background. But more of the story is, the worst part is it feels like you lose your contacts. It's like if you lose your phone, you're like, damn, I lost all my contacts, you know.
Right.
And then everybody who had your number, now you have a new number. So it's like I've had 11 years of relationships I had with people on there that are now just lost. So I'm hoping somehow, some way through this new Twitter account, you know, I'll be able to get some of those people back, because like I said, I've, you know, made some great relationships over the years with folks. So, but that's how you can get at me. I just appreciate you having me on. I enjoyed the hell out of this conversation too.
Yeah, the same as well. And like I said, they're gonna find them like I found you, because I was like, where is he at? And then I randomly found you. I was like, oh, he's 20, he got new Twitter. But the good thing is, you get, maybe you, when you come back, I hope, you know, I just gonna put it in the atmosphere that you get more than 10,000. Maybe you're gonna get 20,000. How about that?
Yeah.
With your podcast.
Appreciate it.
I
always tell my kids, hey, I believe everything happens for a reason, even the madness. So I don't know why this happened, but I gotta believe it happened for a reason. So it's all good. It's all good. But thank you so much, Miss, for having me on.
Oh, no problem. And like you said, check him out on his YouTube, Apartment 5B podcast. Thank you so much for coming on. And you went with the 91 joint, the Gangstar, into the arena. I had to come with some. This next one we're going to play to take us out is the Pete Rock and CL Smooth joint called Mecca and the Soul Brothers from the All Sold Out album. So I had to match the energy. We out, y'all.
All right.
No problem. Soul Tapness Radio, y'all. Every Thursday, 4 to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. We out. Let's go, Will.
Okay. Did you wanna act right and flip the script? Would you wonder why my drama slash comma rip that you're kicking like Pele flows? Even Bono, my versatility capability is simply bougie. Y to the O-U-N-G, another G to the U-N-S. Let's back up shorty from the naughty like Shorty Barry Gordy with a 40 getting paid so naughty. Claim to shoot more rounds than an Uzi. Stop the violence, cause it can't do me. New York to L.A., say what I play. So catch a runaway smooth like a Billie Holiday. You couldn't bag me, boy, with a hefty. Train like Rocky, but still can't step to me. So take a hit, money, leave it alone. And play like Stephanie Mills and find a home. Plus, I never boogaloo with Yaku. We're mixed with the tricks in the alphabet skew. When I design the army, I can reign. But never have more beef than Saddam Hussein. Tonight, cap, so prepare for a gas can when I turn your brain into Mugu Gapan. Finger licking the pace like there is no other. Mecca and the Soul Brother. 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 Schizophrenic on a panic, I do work when you lurk with a professional ceremonial expert. The full swing of an Asiatic acrobatic lover won't sing the blues when I tap it. Save the mystery for Agatha Christie. Give me a break, better wait, Chief Kaniski. I'm not your ordinary modern day cliche, cause I'm here to save your little lost souls anyway. Go with the flow of the flutes when it executes. Any comp living got buried in black suits. The limelight, never let it confuse you. It's a fantasy island without a tattoo. The hardcore you tend to look for. You can't buy another game in a store. Making movies like your name is Faith Dunaway to hear the rumor echo in the project's hallway. You wanna fast break me, no static. But Mr. Ripple can't dribble like magic. I yoke him up in domination, nerds got scrambled. The Tony Randall left in shambles. Finger licking the pigs like there is no other. Mecca and the Soul Brother. 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 Let me see, Pete Rock is like salad dressing when I toss another lesson. Ready or not, prime time after seven. I pull women like a wisdom tooth without any conversation with Dr. Ruth. Making island girls whine with the calamity. With dubs cry, Apollonia and vanity. This is the Mary Jane frame on the mantle. Consider me a vandal, the virgin can't handle. And never clown downtown with past Jack. Popping that gang, ripping homie, don't play that. So don't cast a kid to make a movie while I'm smacking a booty who just love to rock a doobie. Even though I make petty cash like a beggar with no stash, I make an air betting in a sweater. Stole the nightcap for rapping, no slacking back and hand clapping, feet tapping, chief and captain. Just figure lick the pace like there is no other. Mecca and the Soul Brother. 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 Rock
listening live to the Soul Savage Show. Hey, you can check out Q Lens, Soul Savage Show, every Thursday here on CDOW The Buzz, 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time to 7 o'clock on the East and 6 Central. Hey, coming up right now, Mr. Melody and his Mellow Moods.
This is Grown Folks Music.